Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
That's just like a person might come around and say, well, hey, you know, I used to kind of be attracted to people, you know. I've had several wives and all like that. Even had a little incest, I mean, every now and then, I mean, you know. But I finally came to the conclusion that people ain't where it's at all. I'm in the bear. You know. You say, what do you mean you're in the bear? I'm into bear. I go out in the woods and I chase me down a bear. The bear ain't chasing me no more. I'm chasing them. I have found that that's a wonderful alternative. I mean, after all, man, I mean, let's face it. Look at these marriages and divorces and whatnot. I don't have no trouble with the bears. I mean, I used to didn't think of anything about bears except just going to the ball game, you know. But I found out that, man, if you really snuggle up to a bear, you'll never want to go back doing nothing else. Now, where'd you get that idea? Well, it just came to me one night. Tired of these women. In fact, people was telling me, well, if you don't like women, get you a man. Well, I'm tired of them, too. So I'm in the bear. See, now, you might laugh, but it's going to come to that if it ain't already. Because there are some people into that.
Hmm.
Yeah, they call it, what do they call it, bestiality?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, see what I mean? That might be a wholesale thing in about another 10 years. They say, well, hey, well, you know, this gay and lesbian thing about played out, man, ain't where it's at. You know? Man, everybody's trying to preserve the bears now. You know, I'm trying to get me a panda. You know? Now, what is the point that I'm making? It's a lots of things that the mind can do. The mind is extremely inventive and extremely flexible. But the basic question is this type of activity an improvement? And if so, why? Otherwise, why are you coming around asking black people who don't even have a roof over their head that this is what they should be pushing now?
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, June 22nd, 2020. So I have been told, beginning of summer, whoopee, we'll see. Before we get started, today is the deadline. Folks would like to sign up for the COWS, Washington, D.C. Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat. Today is the deadline. August 5 through August 9th, we'll hang out in Washington, D.C., do some counter-racist yoga, plant-based meals, see if we can do some counter-racist workshops, hang out, have fun, do some social distancing. We'll have lots of soap and make sure that we do everything in our power to stay safe, contagion-free, have fun, and get back safely August 5 through the 9th. Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat, Washington, D.C. Today is the deadline to sign up. All the information is on the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Drop an email if you have questions or need any more clarification. Hoping to see folks in the nation's capital for good eats, a little relaxation, certainly needed. Counter-Racist exchange of views. Right on. With that, we will get right to work, man oh man, hopefully, with a discussion. Once we get through with the discussion today of the films that we're going to talk about, hopefully it will offer some information on the system of white supremacy and all of the wackiness that is unfolding throughout this year. Also, hopefully it will make more sense, the audio clip that we heard at the beginning. Should be getting right to it. Hopefully that'll be a little more clear as we proceed. Our guest for today's program, man, we've been broadcasting for 11 plus years. Where has the time gone? We still have been unsuccessful at solving the problem of white supremacy racism. We've been here for 11 years. He is one of the first guests that we had on the program when the Cows got back on the air in 2009. We were checking out different blogs on racism, and there was a blog review for the book Color Monitors, The Blackface of Technology in America. Thought it had lots of great info about white supremacy, and it did a lot of reviews and deconstructing how white supremacy racism operates in a number of different films, especially the sci-fi genre. I think 11 years ago, The Matrix was still a buzz, and the Terminator series has been a buzz for the last 40 years, so that's always in season. But that was what we talked about way back when. And it was just a few weeks ago, I think a listener brought up Dr. Kevorkian, and then I saw the news reports that they're producing a Matrix 4 next summer, and I said, oh my goodness, well, hopefully, you know, either we'll solve racism between now and then so it'll be irrelevant, or if we don't, if we all still exist, we get past the Rona and everything else, then we can have Dr. Kevorkian back next year to discuss the newest installment of the Matrix series. But between now and then, we have a full plate today, and just reminding folks, Dr. Kevorkian was with us almost 4 years ago this time. Election season and everything, turmoil in the streets, police shootings, it was really, really similar to this moment. And we did a film review. Just to show folks, we generally are not messing around and just picking goofy TV. We've said a long time reading is more important than watching television. It certainly is. When we discuss these films and try to analyze the white supremacy components to the films, it's hopefully so that people get a better understanding of this problem, are more cognizant of what they look at if they do watch television, and can maybe even take some of this information to help them solve problems, go about the business of producing justice. That is the hope. The films that we discussed in 2016, 4 years ago, The Purge franchise, that franchise, and they had a new installment of that franchise released 4 years ago during the election, that was a part of why I was so confident our current president was going to be victorious in 2016. If you rewind back in the archives, you will hear that. Actually, I would say the same thing this time around, because it's so similar based on some of the films that we're going to talk about that are relatively new, many of them, and what's unfolding now. We'd say the same thing. 4 more years, but we shall see. Take these films seriously and the critiques that follow. Joining us live, professor of English at the University of Texas, Austin. I don't even know. He's been a guest on the program so many times, I'm not sure what number of visit this is, but it's been a few of them. Joining us once again, Dr. Martin Kevorkian. Such a hoot to have you back with us, sir. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, very, very well. Very well, Mr. Renegade. Thank you, and thank you very much for inviting me back, and thanks to your listeners for thinking of me.
For sure. What a crazy year. We'll try to get covered as much as we can with the time allotted. For folks, I'm sure we have some newer listeners who haven't been with us for the full 11 years. Anything that you would like to share about who you are, the work that you do, before we get started?
Well, thank you very much for mentioning my book. Is now, you know, quite a while ago. It's still the work that I'm my best known for. I'm a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and you know, there's a lot of thinking going on there right now. There's a professor, Leonard Moore, professor of history, professor who teaches, among other things, a course on the history of the Black Power movement, and he has been doing some training for faculty and folks at the university, and just, you know, I was thinking of his remarks when you were talking about, well, if, you know, if we solve, you know, racism, then we don't have to talk about the Matrix, you know, in a year. But, you know, he prefaced his lecture by saying, you know, we're not going to solve racism in 90 minutes. And I think that that's, you know, one of the things that I think you're making a point about Donald Trump is someone who thinks that, you know, these are problems that can be easily dismissed, and we're making such great progress. The people that are teaching at the University of Texas are emphasizing a longer historical perspective. And I'll even give some credit to Netflix on that. You know, one of the times I logged on to Netflix, and it, you know, came up, had recommendations for me to watch things relevant to Black Lives Matter, but the tagline was more than a moment. So, as you said, there's a lot going on at this moment, but it's reminiscent of what was happening 4 years ago, and it's reminiscent of what's been happening for a very long time.
Centuries. Very, very long time. I think we might even have one or two of the films that might be recommended in the next Netflix queue for movies of this moment. Before we get to these wonderful films, let's see, I have two non-film related questions just because it's always great to talk to someone who has expertise with language. The first one is, in this moment, it's been so rife with cliches, and they do that a lot with racism. Lots of cliches and metaphors. We've talked about that before. One that I paid attention to recently is, racism is alive and well. And I said, man, do you hear, like, friends and such? Do they come up to you and say, hey, Martin, how you doing? Do you respond and say, oh, I am alive and well? Like, do you have friends and co-work? Do you hear that phrase used in association with other people or other things? Or is that something that you hear most commonly with racism? And if so, just what would be your thoughts interrogating such phrasing around that racism, alive and well?
Wow. Well, I would imagine that that's a phrase that would be spoken with a kind of bitter irony. That, you know, it's not something that it's saying something is alive and well, but not that you wish this thing will. No, I don't typically hear that applied to people. But it is a phrase that is nevertheless kind of personifying racism as a living thing, a thing that has a life of its own. And to that regard, it might be useful. But on the other hand, it's a thing that's made by people. It's a thing that's sustained by people. It only has the power that people give to it. So there might be some mystification in saying racism is alive and well, as if it is this entity that is self-sustaining. Whereas I think that one of the things, you know, that shows analysis is getting at it, that there's a context for that and there's a system that sustains it. That it's not something that is capable of having a life on its own.
This program, we do try to emphasize racism. The problem is white people. In fact, your colleague at the University of Texas Austin, Dr. Robert Jensen, that is right out of his book, The Heart of Whiteness, how he says it's so important we do all these things where we distance white supremacy racism from white people and come up with all these tacky phrases and cliches as opposed to, yes, racism is alive and well. White people who practice racism are alive and well. So, yes, racism would be here. But just getting folks to pay attention, because, I mean, we're in a world, they say, of infinite possibilities, right? You have all these billions of language combinations. I just took a casual look, did a search today. Okay, so alive and well, that phrase. So we got one, this song is alive and well. The next one, letter to the editor, racism, alive and well. Next one, spirit of fiesta, alive and well. Next one, keep your plants alive and well. Next one, noose found in Bubba Watson's garage, reminder that racism is alive and well. Next one is the housing market is alive and well. Next we got Israel, racism is alive and well, so it's global. Next one, racism is alive and well in Loudoun County, Alabama. Next one, 7 ways American racism is all alive and well. That's... just ask, I mean, wow, like, they tell you to be conscious of cliches, like, it seems like people have that one ready-made, like, oh, we're about to die from the Rona and all kinds of financial troubles and everything else, but amidst all of that, racism is thriving, alive and well. My other quick non-film related question related to language. You just said system that is operating. We had someone point out over the weekend in Norway, he pointed out there's a distinction between systemic racism, system of white supremacy. He said, I think it's a substantial difference between those two. Just being someone who studies language, how would you interrogate the difference between those two phrases? Systemic racism, system of racism.
Good. That's a sharp call. And I would say, first of all, to say the positives on system of white supremacy. One, right away, it emphasizes what you said a moment ago from Robert Jensen, that we're talking about something sustained by white people for their benefit. And a system is an organized thing sustained by actions that support white supremacy. Systemic racism, kind of like the metaphor of racism being alive and well, this is almost sounds like a diagnosis of a disease. Like the problem is systemic. It's an adjective, and it's an adjective that is then describing this noun, racism, which again is almost characterized as being self-sustaining or having a life of its own, whereas system of white supremacy emphasizes the built, designed, and humanly sustained constructiveness of that system.
Love it. Love it. Words are so important. Super, super important. And that's, in my opinion, there are lots of ways that white supremacy racism is discussed. And in my view, is encouraged that we discuss and think about racism, white supremacy as this thing, this nebulous thing that's kind of out there and causes problems from time to time, like George Floyd or whatever's happening in Israel, that causes these problems, as opposed to, no, it's individuals classified as white around the world who cause these problems, maintain the system of white supremacy. I think that's important distinction, came up yesterday. All righty. Wow. It is film time. I'm so excited. Woo. I picked all of the films today. So anybody, listeners, Dr. Kevorkian even, I mean, he's a professor at a major institution. So we should not be wasting people's time, period. And particularly under these conditions where we got protests and health crisis and all the rest of it. So no wasting time. Hopefully folks will benefit from what we are getting into today. I said Dr. Kevorkian has been with us many times throughout the years. And one of those times, in fact, if my memory is not too bad, we had him on the program. It was right after President Trump won the election, thought he was, we were correct, whoopee, we did our victory lap. We said, hey, we can discuss Black Mirror because we already got this. We were ahead of the curve. Everybody was wrong and didn't see how this was going to happen, and we already predicted this. So can kick our feet up now, and we'll discuss Black Mirror. We went through the season. I think at that time it went through the first three seasons. And then we've come back and discussed it a little bit more. The fifth season came out last summer, three installments. We're just doing one episode before we push off to the other products that we talked about. Wow. Striking Vipers, the one episode that we're looking at from season five of Black Mirror. A lot of the similar themes that we've discussed before on the program with this series. I guess I'll get you, in case we have listeners, I'm sure we do, who haven't seen it, to give us kind of a synopsis of this film. But I just want to read a little snippet from Color Monitors. It reminded me a lot, or this film reminded me of this portion of your book. This is on page 29. You're actually talking about Terminator 2. We'll get back to that franchise later. So you're talking about Miles Dyson's character. This is a Black male who actually did the narrative for Invisible Man that we read, my favorite book ever. He did the narration for that audiobook. So this is the bottom of 29. You write, another loaded shot from Terminator 2 both exemplifies and attempts to justify this strategy of containment. At Cyberdyne headquarters, we find Miles Dyson situated between the young John Connor, Edward Furlong, and his kinder, gentler Terminator. The composition, with the left to right ascending line connecting the heads of child, programmer, and Terminator, uses Dyson's position to recapitulate his status. In the filmmaker's vision, Dyson is indeed between child and machine as a being. So, Striking Vipers, if you had to sum it up quickly for folks who have not seen this film, and then maybe you can see, wow, what does that passage have to do with this here installment?
Thank you very much. Striking Vipers, the title refers to a video game. I'll just remind you that it's written, episode written by Charlie Brooker, who's the creator of Black Mirror. So as you said, it's similar to, has some similar themes to a lot of the other episodes. Specifically, this episode was directed by Owen Harris, and the two other Black Mirror episodes that he directed were both ones that we've discussed previously. Most notably, the similarity is to San Junipero, to my mind. It's got a lot of similarities to that episode, which is one that Mr. Renegade helped us critique when we discussed it. The story focuses on two friends. Their names are Carl and Danny. They are African-American friends, and we first see them when they're in their 20s, and they're playing this Striking Vipers video game together. And then we catch up with them 11 years later to see how their lives have developed. We see at this point that Danny is married to Theo, a non-white woman who we also met, in the initial scene. But what happens is that Carl, Danny's friend, gives for him for his 38th birthday, the game Striking Vipers X, which now is much more advanced than kind of the low resolution version that they enjoyed playing together many years ago. And this one comes with a VR add-on, a virtual reality add-on. Carl says, it blew my mind, to confetti. He gives it to Danny, and they play the game together in this virtual reality setting. Previously, in just the regular video game, they controlled two characters named Roxette, who in the low-res graphics, you can see her as a blonde woman, and then a young man named Lance. When it goes into the high-resolution virtual reality version of Striking Vipers X, you get Roxette again as a blonde woman, this time possibly of Asian descent, and Lance also portrays an Asian man. It's kind of a version like, the game is basically like a Mortal Kombat type of game. But after a little bit of fighting, what happens in the game is that Danny controlling Lance and Carl controlling Roxette end up having virtual sex in the game, and they develop an obsession with hooking up together in cyberspace. In that way, we see that for a long time, because of this machine-based relationship, that Danny's relationship to his wife Theo is compromised. There's a heartbreaking scene where she says, "Why don't you want me? You always used to want me." So there's this idea of this man that has been removed or has had a compromised, a loving relationship with his wife in favor of this fantasy that is actually de-physicalized, but only exists in the virtual realm. Made me think of a lot of different critiques. Maybe one documentary that I might recommend along the way is a James Baldwin documentary. I've recommended his books before, and I learned a lot from his book, The Devil Finds Work, specifically. That's when I've been doing my research. But he talks about the way that black men and entertainment for white audiences are portrayed as if they are lacking equipment. They are de-sexualized. On the one hand, there's the stereotype of fear of the predatory black man, but on the other hand, there are all these representations of the black man that has somehow been neutralized. And in this case, we have a representation of a sexuality that has been neutralized by being projected entirely into this realm, this virtual realm. It is not a very good summary, but we do see that damage to the relationship. Eventually, the wife confronts him. Theo confronts Danny. We understand that he has explained the situation to her. He does pull out of that virtual realm. He and Theo then do have another child, but we see down the road that some sort of deal has been made that every day on his birthday, he and Carl will then get together in this virtual realm, and as some sort of trade-off, his wife gets to go have an affair. And it's another one of those episodes where, you know, it feels like it wants to be portrayed as somehow liberating or exploring possibilities in the virtual realm, but it seems sad for everyone in the story.
Extremely sad for everybody in the story. And yeah, just for listeners, let's see, Danny's character, Anthony Mackie, we will see him again today, and he doesn't get good roles. Anthony Mackie, get a new agent if you're listening. Man, we talked about the Hurt Locker, and he had a white man straddling his face in that one. I think he got an Academy Award, not Anthony Mackie, the white man, I think, got an Academy Award for straddling, riding him in the Hurt Locker. Get a new agent, Anthony Mackie. Geez, he gets horrible roles. We'll talk more about Anthony Mackie today, but back with Black Mirror and Striking Vipers specifically. Accurate summary, the conclusion, spoiler alert, not that I don't really care about the spoilers for folks who are going to watch or what have you, but the sad, pitiful conclusion, as you just said, where his wife, she gets, I guess, her day marked on the calendar where she can take off her wedding ring and go and have an affair of some sort, I guess what they call an open marriage type thing, and he's at home on the couch with the video game headset that we've seen before. We've seen this in USS Callister, where you can just kind of space out on the video reality, and he can have sex with his friend, male friend. And I'll just read that passage again, or just the one sentence. Dyson's, or in the filmmaker's vision, Dyson is indeed between child and machine as a being. There's a birthday that's kind of at the beginning of Striking Vipers where Danny's character, I think he's turning 38, 39, something really close to 40, because they're like, oh man, you're almost 40. He says, yep, then after that it's death. They have their little gallows humor moment and go on. So they're midlife, they're trying to have another child and all of this, married, you know, just doing what married couples would do after several years. And so as opposed to him functioning like a husband, a father, because we even have the scene not too long after the birthday when he first gets the video game and starts having this tragic arrangement or tragic situation with his male friend, his son comes and kicks him and he has to exit the game. He's like, I'm thirsty, what are you doing? And he's like, oh man, disheveled and trying to get it. I mean, Not being a father, you're on this game. Not being a husband, totally neutralized, taking the language from James Baldwin. I want to just play a quick sound clip just for listeners if, you know, they haven't seen, just to kind of get an idea. And then I can bring it back to the beginning with the sound clip. If anybody's sitting there like, he's talking about polar bears. Like, what is going on with sex with bears? What are we even talking about? So this is Black Mirror striking vipers. They're at the dinner table. So this is after the affair thing has been going on for a while. And I think the wife and Danny's character, Anthony Mackie, they've already had their squabble and, you know, what's going on? Do you not want to kiss me anymore and all that? So at this point, she is inviting over his male friend, his lover, in fact, inviting him over. They're at the dinner table. It's super awkward. The wife hasn't quite figured out, like, what's going on. So she's going to go get dessert and we'll hear the exchange between the two of them. And then we'll get a reprieve to kind of help folks. If you're a little still confused about the bear remarks at the beginning from Mr. Fuller, you should be all caught up. Context of white supremacy. Black Mirror.
Fantasy and dessert is as crazy as it gets now. Speaking of dessert, I think it's almost ready. Mm-hmm.
What the fuck are you doing?
Just eating.
That's not what I mean, okay? Why the fuck did you come here?
She asked me to come. What do you want me to say?
An excuse.
Such as what?
Such as anything.
What am I, like your ex-wife or something?
Look, it's too strange, okay? It's just too fucking strange.
I told you it was strange. Nothing matches it. Does it? I try replacing it, man. I try. I try fucking the computer controlled characters. It's bullshit. Shut up. It's like a rubber doll. I'm not programmed for any sex stuff. They just sort of lie there. I tried it with real players. Other folks controlling lands. There was this one guy from Holland. He was kind of halfway okay, as long as I didn't think about his accent. But it didn't get me. It didn't get me. Not like when we were in there, you and me. Stop it. I'm trying everything. I've gone in there as God, players, girl, players, multiplayer, gangbangs, you name it. You know, I even fucked Tundra, the polar bear character. I fucked a polar bear. And I still couldn't get you out of my mind.
I can't help you.
You're gonna fuck Roxy again.
I don't.
You do. Just the best sex of my life. Best of yours, too. Fucking transcendent, you know it was. Think about it. Think about her. Roxy, holding her. Her warm skin against yours.
Please.
A tight, wet pussy.
Fuck, man.
She'll be in there at midnight. Just come on in one last time. You know you want to one last time. One last time.
What y'all doing?
You take a good long look before you go plunging in. Okay, you know, because there's an old saying, if you snore in a bear's face long enough, you'll learn to like it. But bear might not be where it's at, you know. You might get to the place where you can't bear it, but it'll be too late. Because now you're hooked, just like the chief got hooked on that whiskey.
Context of white supremacy. Any thoughts on that scene, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, it again speaks to the portrayal of the intensity of this addiction to the gang relationship that takes them completely out of the ability to have normal human relationships, even with one another. These guys are friends. I mean, there's the tragedy of the ruined relationship with the right, but there's also the tragedy that this has I mean, it says that they can't be friends, as you said, that there's this example, we bring full circle, where the Carl character says he's tried everything, you know, even the polar bear. Again, that speaks to the way that this representation has turned both of them into something not of the human order. Again, you framed it with the idea of being between child and machine. They're playing this childhood game, which, as they say, has become, they emphasize it as a serious game, but it's a game that takes them out of human sexuality and human relationships and puts them into relationship with machine as animal.
The Man Knot, Dr. Tommy Curry's work frequently comes to mind. Black people are not human beings. If you're not a human being, you can be treated any kind. Yes, have sex with a polar bear. Yes, have sex with a machine. Yes, you know, of course you're not going to be a husband. Human beings are, non-humans are not husbands. I didn't want to gloss over it, but just I think they covered all their bases in their representation of kind of the non-humanness of black people. The significance of Danny's wife, her name is Theo. Significance, that being the name for his wife, Theo, T-H-E-O.
Yeah. Again, this is something that, you know, you've spoken about before, that one of the fundamental moves of dehumanization is to separate the human from the creator. And so there is a theological dimension, the idea of, you know, in the relationship with Theo, it's a relationship that is that of, you know, children of God together. So I think that there's that dimension of Theo that is being lost in this dehumanized relationship. And then one of the things, again, from this quotation, this clip that you just played, there's a claim made that the relationship, as Carl experiences and Danny experiences, is transcendent. So it's a falsely divine relationship. It puts them in an order that is in which the machine is the god, which they are to worship, and it almost gives the machine a creator relationship over them. If it's not that they say that we're having this unsatisfying, diminished relationship. No, there's a particular relationship that is here presented as most appropriate for them in that machine realm rather than the earthly realm of God's creation.
Context of white supremacy. I think something you point out in the book in terms of a lot of times these themes, you'll see them repeated. If it's a franchise, you'll see the themes repeated not just within one movie, but you'll see those themes repeated within the franchise. In my view, it's one of the strongest themes in the Black Mirror franchise, either hypersexualizing black people or totally dehumanizing them through whatever sexual activity they're going to be involved in. But somehow it's just watching, observing their conduct, it's going to be a lot of sexual behavior, and it's going to be kind of degraded, I would even say non-human degraded sexual conduct. And just good, we talked about this, I'm so glad you pointed that out. Owen Harris, who directed this film, also did San Junipero. I'd say it's a classier version, but it's the same thing. The main black female character who's there to help the white woman with her sexual experience, her first sexual experience with another female. This black female is there, and all of these white people. She's got white men pursuing her, white women pursuing her for sexual intercourse, same type of thing. Even though she was married to a black husband in her life for 50 years, in this dream world, she's, you know, just everyone's, yes, come have a good time, girl. This comes up again, Man Against Fire. The main black male character, one, he doesn't even have a name, so the dehumanization is on many levels. They end up just calling him Stripe, some nickname. But his reward is he gets to have this fantasy, same thing, fantasy of sexual intercourse. It's with a black female, but they clone the black female. So it ends up being like, it starts out, it's he and she, and then it's he and like six of her. So it's like, wow, you can just replicate, you know, non-human being. You can just make 50 of them, 20 of them. They're like sheep or clones or whatever. This comes up in USS Callister. Talk about neutralization. They don't even have genitals. And you pointed out last time in the USS Callister, it's the black characters, once they're liberated and they get out of this oppressive situation, they get their genitals back. It's the black characters who notice that, and the camera locks on them in this kind of cheeky moment, and they kind of look at each other and giggle like, oh, we got our genitals back. Ooh, let's go do something X-rated. This comes up again in Hang the DJ, which is season 4, where same thing, white man, black female. They get together in this kind of virtual setting, and I think you pointed out when we talked about this, as opposed to the white man being the traditional man, and I'm going to take the role, get to the bedroom and do all that, it's the other way around. The black female has to take the role and be the aggressor, and I think she said some really crude comments, I'm going to see your penis, before she initiates. And then later I pointed it out, I thought it was important, they showed the black female character engaged in sexual intercourse again with white men, black males, and white women. They didn't do that with the white male character. They only showed him having sexual intercourse with another female. Again, black people in general, just whatever. Sex with bears, people, whatever. Anything you can think of. This comes up again. National Anthem. I totally forgot any discussion of Black Mirror. The first episode of the series, which I was going to talk about right now anyway, but the first episode of the series, they have a white man rape a pig. So any show where that's the pilot, you should probably think about whether you want to watch it or not. That said, the racism, or the same pattern there, they have the character Malaika. She's a journalist, and she sends nude pictures to try to curry favors with a white man. She ends up getting shot later. But the same sort of thing, she's not just a devious journalist, sexually devious non-white journalist. And the last one, 15 Million Merits, the black male character, I forgot the main actor's name, but he's the fellow who played the lead in Get Out. But he basically goes crazy, a la the Shakespeare, Othello, goes crazy for this white woman that he cannot have. And then he gets tortured. He has to watch her having sex with a black male on the porn channel and almost goes crazy. So am I talking crazy? But that seems like a main theme throughout the whole franchise of Black Mirror, really dehumanizing, degrading sexual depictions of black people. Am I talking crazy, Dr. Kevorkian?
No, sir, you are not. You're speaking the truth. Yeah, I would say that there, that theme of that sexual degradation does run throughout. And again, I thought, you know, I thank you for expanding that. You know, I saw the most obvious connection was to San Junipero, and particularly not just the range of sexual degradation, but the way that episode placed the power in the hands of the white woman, in this case played by Mackenzie Davis, who we'll hear from later in Terminator Dark Fate. I saw the connection between her and the blonde avatar Roxette, in which in both cases the black character, you know, prefers a fantasy of the blonde woman to any sort of real relationship, long-standing faithful relationship with a loving married partner. So that was the central tragedy for me, but it is also consistently shown that it comes with a degradation. It goes hand in hand with that. I'd also say that there's one of the things that Striking Vipers really emphasizes. You say that when they plug in this VR pod to their brain, they really zone out. It's really striking the way that just the black woman, they're plugged in this, they just kind of collapse backward, and you see a complete loss of control that is portrayed. So there's the idea that, you know, not that they are playing the game, but that the game is playing them. You see that theme emphasized at a couple of different points, even with Danny's relationship to his dishwasher, right? Like at several points, he's loading the dishwasher and he gets what's called a hardware warning. And then later again, you know, the command from the machine, please reach distance before program start. Even the point that even in his relationship with his wife, when they're going to have a relationship, it's because the app tells them that it's time to have relationships because that would be the time for them to get pregnant. You see, you know, a man who has been diminished by having every aspect of his life controlled by machines.
Wow. Let's see. I thought it was also really important when they go into this virtual reality, they do not, neither of them, select black people. They both get non-white people, Danny's character, Asian male, the other fella, Carl, he gets a non-white female who has a white parent. So I guess I would, non-white female, I think she's got paraphernalia, her the way that her character is portrayed, I think it's a non-white female, but she does have a white parent. But both phenotypically very far from crystal black. These are folks who would in no way be confused with black people. I thought that was important. And I had the same feeling, and it was pretty immediate. Like this, when I saw this the first time, it was the same feeling I had as when I watched Lakeview Terrace, and we discussed Lakeview Terrace, Samuel L. Jackson, and I felt an immediate feeling of nausea, like, oh man, this is going to be really bad. Like, oh, Sam Jackson is not going to come out well in this one, and he does not. I had that same feeling in this one within about the first, it was pretty quick, within about three, I didn't know what it was going to be about. I was watching it with someone else, and I think both of us within about 3 minutes, like, oh man, we should have picked something else. This was a bad choice. And by the time I got to the, I was nauseous. I was totally weak. I was reminded of this, like, wow. And I'll just, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. is the person commenting about, you know, having sexual intercourse with a bear, and is this an improvement, and what are we doing, and all of the, why are we bringing this to black people, where you, they're even saying as a part of all this, and Hollywood's so white, and the small representation of black people, why with this? And this was like the, yay, let's be excited, Black Mirror season 5, why would this be something where I would say, yeah, this is an awesome representation of black people. Sex with polar bears? Yeah. Great. Outstanding. Not taking care of your child so you can go have, pretend to be a white woman? Having sex with a black male who's pretending to be an Asian male? Yes. Bravo. Best thing I've seen in, I don't know, since The Help. Anything that you wanted to get in before we push off to our next film?
No. Thank you. But yeah, I did also note that, particularly about the you know, the portrayal of the father as being separated also from the son, and then yeah, that's
it. Absolutely horrendous. Black Mirror, like us. No need to watch the rest of it. A lot of the same patterns in the whole series. Like, whew, that was more than enough. If they make any more of the season, I will not be participating. But again, the series starts with a white man raping a pig, so, you know, you've kind of been warned.
Well, I will quote.
Yes, sir.
I will say there was one moment where I identified, and you know, that was like a moment, like there's, as you said, there's this nausea, and there's this sense that this is going to be bad, and there's going to be doom. But when Danny says, you know, I need to make a clean break, and I think, yeah, that's how this makes you feel about Black Mirror. But yeah,
absolutely, make a clean break. Absolutely, let it go. Let It Go. Even within all of this, I've been seeing Black Mirror constantly. Like, they've had, I think they had advertisements with mirrors up saying this is the worst season of Black Mirror ever, ha ha ha. And they even interviewed Charlie Brooke about all of this. And yeah, clean break. Moving forward, context of white supremacy. If you have questions, comments, the number is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Wow, man. The next film, Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo. Now, this here film is really old. We're talking about a film that is almost 40 years old. We would not have been talking about this film at all if it were not for what is happening right now. I said this was not some random hodgepodge. I'm sitting at home with too much time during the quarantine, and let me just pick some random Netflix. Not at all. This was looking at the newspaper every day, and, oh, okay, these are films that I would select to talk about to help explain all of this. Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo. Not a good movie. You don't need to watch it. You can just listen to the dialogue and hopefully glean some constructive information. So I will read. This is from The Hollywood Reporter. Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo, director on Boogaloo Extremists, a surrealistic situation. So this was just published June 17th, 2020. And there are lots of these. NPR, like I just picked this one because, but I mean, there are tons of these reports. So it reads, the pro-Civil War group behind Two Killings takes its name from the cult 80s breakdancing film. A few days ago, Sam Furstenberg, the Israel-born movie director behind the 80s cult classic Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo, and American Ninja, was scanning a newspaper when he couldn't believe his eyes. It's almost bizarre, a surrealistic situation, said Furstenberg, 70. He read about a domestic anti-U.S. government extremist movement, notice they didn't say racist white supremacist, that had sprouted in the dark recesses of the internet and amid the recent protests over coronavirus lockdowns and George Floyd's killing has sprung terrifyingly to life. And the movement named itself after one of his movies. The Boogaloo movement has exploded into the... Woo! I had to tell you why I'm laughing once I get through with this. Sorry, I'll start over. The Boogaloo movement has exploded into the mainstream in the recent days after it came to light that Staff Sergeant Steve Carrillo, who on May 29th used the cover of the Floyd protests to gun down one federal officer and injure another in Oakland, California, claims allegiance to the group. Carrillo later scrawled the word Boog, B-O-O-G, in his own blood on the hood of a stolen vehicle during a June 6 gun battle with police in Santa Cruz County that also claimed a sheriff's deputy's life. I did not hear this blown up. According to New York Times, the movement originated on platforms like Reddit, 4chan, and Facebook. Its name derived as an inside joke from the 1984 cult classic film Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo. Its followers often wear brightly colored aloha shirts because Boogaloo also sounds like Big Luau. The Boogaloo Boys' one goal, to hasten a second civil war. On message boards, it was referred to as Civil War II, Electric Boogaloo. That's where the name originated. Until only recently, Electric Boogaloo was a lighthearted meme. In the last 10 years or so, it became equal with the word sequel. I'll stop there. It goes on. They reunited the cast on Yahoo to talk about, you know, their memories. I think Muhammad Ali came on the set and, you know, what they think about the name from their film being used in the midst of all this. Before we get to the film, which is interesting of itself, well, not really, but what are your thoughts on why individuals, I would say, are suspected white supremacists? Why would they pick this term, Boogaloo, to attach to their movement? What do you make of that as someone who studies language?
Yeah, I mean, the question is, I mean, the claim is that, you know, they're treating, they want a second civil war. And I think, you know, there are many of them that are not just alleged, you know, white supremacists, that they declare you've made. It's not a complete uniform movement, but there have been statements made that are about white separatism, white nationalism, anti-black, anti-Semitic statements. I think part of it is that they think of it as a silly sounding sequel. It's not just any sequel. I mean, if the argument was that, that I've heard was that, Break Into Electric Boogaloo is indistinguishable from Break In, like it's a sequel that was just like the first one, and they're going to have a civil war that's going to replay the second civil war, and it's going to be a race war again. That doesn't explain then why you would just pick Break Into Electric Boogaloo. I mean, it could, why not I Still Know What You Did Last Summer or some other, sequel of that nature. So I think that, even the Hawaiian Church, I think, is not, completely explained by the big luau sounding nature of it. That both of these things are meant to play as kind of jokey and comic. I've seen one analysis of the movement that says it gives kind of the cover of wacky outrageousness to do serious, dangerous, violent white supremacist things. There is that idea that they're having a laugh at the same time that they think of the word boogaloo perhaps as somehow funny. I mean, there's even a character, in the movie that kind of makes fun of people's names. The two main characters are Turbo and Ozone, the two main dancers who are the protagonists. And there's a white man that makes fun of them by calling them Turbine and Bozo. And Bozo is a very specific mistake for Ozone because it takes it into the realm of clownishness or mockery or a joke. So that's what I suspect when I think, why did they land on that sequel for their Civil War terrifying fantasy? It's to have this strain, to be able to play in this realm of strained ambiguity where people don't know if they're joking or not. And also to have an edge of mockery and of laughing at the supposed silliness of a movie with it that would call itself this.
I do have that sound clip. This isn't, a movie that's worth a whole lot of time, so probably won't have a whole lot to say about it, but I do think it is important because it's directly connected to white people armed in the street, many of them, as you said, making explicitly racist white supremacist comments. Why would they pick this name to attach to? This is the sound clip where we will hear, so in this film, so what's my 20-second synopsis? It's a bunch of mostly black people, poor black people, who dance in the streets and make very little money. A white woman is in some... Oh, man. So a white woman appears to be in some sort of tragic arrangement with one of these fellows. Turbo, I believe. And she's like she's a professionally trained dancer. She has lots of options. She doesn't have to do this, but she hangs out with the black people. And they're going to lose their community center if they don't get money. You see white people making plans about building a shopping mall and gentrification, racial dislocation. And they end up having a big party. And ultimately, two white people basically save the day. This white woman, Kelly, her parents write a big check. And the white people who were going to make this a shopping mall change their minds after pressure and donate a lot of money. And they do some other fundraising and such. But these two white people are the big ones. White people could end racism today, and that's a great illustration right there. Anyway, that's basically the film, the end. Lots of dancing in between. It's mostly dancing in the streets. But this is the sound clip where the parents, white female, her name is Kelly, her white parents, you can hear them grousing, and you'll hear what Dr. Kevorkian just said about the names being deliberately jumbled.
What's this Stanley tells me about our daughter dancing in Paris?
Darling, she doesn't even have the job yet.
And I also understand that she's been back in the streets with that bozo or turbine or whatever the hell their names are.
She isn't in the streets, sweetheart. She's volunteering. It's charity work. She is helping all those poor little underprivileged children.
Yeah, well, I'm going to do something about this nonsense.
Well, darling, I don't know what you can do. Kelly's old enough to make her own decisions.
I'm going to find a way. Call her up.
Yes, dear.
Get her over here for dinner.
Yes, dear.
I want to talk to that girl.
Yes, dear.
That was a tennis ball that you heard. He had his tennis racket Welsing moment. I almost got the ISIS papers to read about that, but he got his tennis racket in his rage. Broke a window in the house. His wife was exercising the whole time. Incidentally, I think that scene is a great representation of racist man, racist woman. They're not ignorant about racism. The father is clearly upset that his daughter, because they even used the coded language by 84 when this movie came out. They don't say niggers or the colors or what. Underprivileged children. But the wife, she's just exercising. She doesn't get upset. Hey, she'll make her own choices. She'll figure it out. Blah, blah, blah. The foul, gotta get in here. I'm so upset about this. Two different styles of racism, white supremacy. One more refined, one more explicit. But I was reminded when he said exactly what you pointed out, turbine and bozo, deliberately messing up their names. It reminded me, this is from Color Monitors on 131. So you're talking about the Matrix here, paying attention to the names of these characters. You write, this is talking about Tank and Bulldozer. Dozer. These are two of the black characters from the Matrix, the first one. Because of their nature, Tank and Dozer, pure humans, named after earthly tools, are perfectly suited to do all the digital heavy lifting. Tank and Dozer also turn out to be disposable supplements to the heroes. Both of the brothers suffer fatal blastings, with Tank holding on just long enough to connect a final sequence of exits. The first movie does not even make clear that Tank dies. His role as an interchangeable tool renders his person so disposable that his death takes place not only off screen, but without remark. But apparently he did die. No one who will be missed. We did talk about Pulp Fiction. And the resistance continues to need operators. For the sequel, The Matrix Reloaded, the team must recruit another networking expert. The racialized pattern holds true, providing further confirmation that the casting for such roles is not random. The second time around, a dreadlocked Harold Perrineau Jr. portrays the rebel ship's operator. Reloading his character, the screenwriters perfect the technique of functional labeling. This black networking whiz goes by the name of Link. So we got Link, Dozer, Tank, and from Breaking 2, Ozone, Turbo. Now, albeit we can say that they're dancers, but Kelly is a dancer too. And she got an actual name. I think that's important, just with naming of characters. Any more you would add to Turbo and Ozone? What are we to make of the naming of these characters? And even how it kind of fits with some of exactly what you write about with the characters from The Matrix, yes?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much for pointing it out, Mr. Renegade. The thought that Turbine, Turbine and Bozo, or Turbo and Ozone, are like the Tank and Dozer in that naming. And Kelly is like the Trinity character in The Matrix. Like, you've got the Tank and Dozer that have those functional names, and then you have Trinity, who has this transcendent special name. And even Kelly, you know, mostly she goes by Kelly, but when she gets her nickname is Special K. I mean, I guess you could say, yeah, that's a cereal, but she's the one who is special, rather than someone who's identified as being part of the industrial machine world, whether it be the machinery of the turbo or the ozone that's created by it. So in the plot of the movie, as you also see, what is crucial is that Kelly and the dad and the white folks in the movie get to have choices. They get to have options, and the non-white characters consistently do not. There's the case where at one point the dad offers to early on saved the day. It says, you know, I'll write you the check to save your community center if Kelly will just go to Princeton and stop his dancing nonsense. I think he, you know, you mentioned different euphemisms. One of the euphemisms I think he uses is, you know, dancing with street people is his coded language for what he doesn't want her to do. And Ozone speaks up very, very proudly, but really is speaking up for Kelly's wishes and supporting her dream. And tells her, don't take the money from your dad. That's not what you want. And he further says, no one's going to tell me when to throw down my pride. And he tells the dad, I don't need your money. But at the end, as you say, Mr. Renegade, it is the dad's money that saves the day. So Kelly gets to have her dream, but Ozone, you know, what that ending refutes what Ozone says, that he doesn't need his money. The movie at the end tells us that the white man's money was needed. It was what saved the day.
Absolutely. I thought that was really important, too. Just, I mean, when we talk about system of white supremacy and people squabble about that, this is a movie, but I mean, I guess you can say now, is this true? So when it's depicting, you know, what people are doing, they show white people, as I said, they're in an office with plans. This is what is going to happen to this neighborhood, and we're going to build this here. We have plans for the next 6 months, the next year, civil engineers and plotting, you know, what this neighborhood, what this city is going to look like. You see the black people, I think Ozone, they live in a garage. That's what it looks like to me. I might be incorrect. It certainly is not Kelly's house, but to me it looks like a garage. I'll say if somebody has seen Breaking 2, Dr. Gavoy, have you seen? It looks like a garage to me, the facility that they're in. They are not in charge of anything. They're working at the center and mostly dancing in the streets for crumbs, which they say at the beginning, and in the dirt sometimes, on cardboard. I mean, system of white supremacy. Racism is alive and well in the world of Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo. The reason that I began cackling as I was trying to read the article about this film, I was watching the movie to prepare for the program. So I watched it this past weekend. And the protests have been going on around the world. And in a number of the protests, at least here in the U.S., dancing has broken out in the streets. They've had a number of videos that have gone viral where, like, enforcement officers have come out and joined with protesters. I think they signed some agreement in one location and they went and did, like, the electric slide out in the street and some other numbers and things. And so I did have that in my mind. I've seen that like many times, and that happened, I think, in 2016 and some other times where, you know, this kind of thing did happen. So I was watching it this weekend, and so I looked at that. They went out and they jumped on the trucks and were dancing and all of that. And then I looked back and I pulled up the video footage of them dancing in the streets. And I said, did they think like this is what, you know, black people are going to do? They're going to go out and dance in the street and act like, woo, it was a tough moment where it was a little too close to what I actually saw. Have you seen those videos when they actually have been out dancing in the street?
I have not seen that. No.
I will have to send you several, because it's not just a one-time thing. It's been many of them, like I said, with sometimes enforcement officers, like getting into it and really excited about it and the whole nine. Like, it's been a number of them. If other folks have seen it, it's quite a visual. Did you have something else?
Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, that just because it's a silly movie doesn't mean that breakdancing is silly. You know, I mean, it's that's just a stupid, obvious thing to say, but, you know, I don't see the existence of the dancing in the movie as any way undermining, you know, I mean, not having seen this clip, but undermining the expression that, you know, can be achieved through dance. So.
Absolutely. No criticism of breakdancing or dance in general. Just trying to evaluate the film and replace white supremacy with justice. I have another sound clip from this film. Incidentally, before I get to my other sound clip, I am reminded, Dr. Kevorkian's been with us many times. I talked about the quote from one of Nixon's staff members. He was in the Department of agriculture. He had the quote that black people, all they want is loose shoes, sexual intercourse, and a warm place to sleep. I was thinking about that quote, and I would say if you watch a movie like this, that's kind of how black people are depicted in the film. They're not in charge of anything. It's kind of dance, sexual interest, dance, some sort of, you know, disagreement or quarrel with other non-white dancers. But I mean, it's a pretty limited scope of interests for the black people that are presented. Just remembering that quote that we've talked about. But I do have one more quote from this film before we shuffle off. This is, I think there are a lot of different times where it's films or books or people in general will suggest that black people are racist too. And I think there was one of those moments in this film. There's a female character. She's kind of upset. I think she might have been a love interest of Ozone, who's one of the main characters. He's in the tragic arrangement with Kelly. And so she's kind of giving her nasty looks throughout the film. And so she finally confronts her. I think this is one of those moments, I think, where it's kind of suggesting, yeah, black people are racist too. Look at how they're treating Special K. This is a second clip from Breaking 2.
What's the matter, honey? Did Ozone break your little heart?
He's not your type, girl.
I really don't want to talk about it right now, okay? I suggest you stay away from him. Just leave me alone.
You don't belong with Ozone. You don't belong in this neighborhood.
Honey, you just keep showing your pretty little face around here. And it's not going to stay pretty much longer.
Is this just standard jealousy, or is this, you know, maybe suggesting, hey, black people are kind of racist too. Look at how they're treating this, saying that she doesn't belong around here and such.
Yeah, I wrote down that quotation that, you know, that you don't belong around here, and really thought that the character who speaks at Rhonda, portrayed as a non-white character, is part of the whole tragedy here, that she does appear to have real feelings. I think it, on one level, the screenplay is portraying her as, you know, excluding poor Special K and maybe being racist to her. But I mean, if you actually look at, you know, the levels of respect and who cares for whom and who is willing to sacrifice themselves for whom, you know, Rhonda seems to have some feelings for the community for Ozone. But, you know, earlier on, you know, Kelly, you know, just, as you say, classically trained dancer. I think her agent, her white agent, is asking about her relationship with Ozone. And the agent says, "Do you love him?" And Kelly says, "I just like the way he dances." And maybe, you know, it's, you were supposed to understand she's lying, but I mean, she says straight up, she betrays him, you know, when challenged, "Do you really love him?" Whereas you have someone like Rhonda, I think, you know, she wouldn't hesitate to say that, you know, that she likes, you know, likes Ozone. So I thought that was kind of a tagline for the whole movie. Do you love him? I just like the way he dances. That this is a movie that was designed to make money off of non-white people dancing. It was extremely profitable on a small budget. You know, not a film made a lot of craft, but it was, you know, it exploited that dancing for a profit. So, yeah, I'm glad that you point that out, that it is one of those instances in which it tries to, you know, kind of, so to speak, even things out. You've got some obviously racist white people, but who are, to a large extent, redeemed in the end. And I'll say the thing about Rhonda is she's the one person who sort of doesn't get what she, who most doesn't get what she wants at the end. Like, everyone else gets their either turned around or gets, you know, gets with the program and gets some version of a happy ending, but her dissatisfaction with not being able to be with Ozone is never finally addressed or resolved.
Wow. Good point. That is a very good point, that line where she says that, "I just like the way that he dances." Like, you know, it's the fact that it could easily be, like she said, she has choices. Like, it could easily be true, it can easily not be true. She has, like, the power is with her. She is, we talked about that a lot, the power in those tragic arrangements is with the white person. About Ozone does not have any choices at all. He's at the community center, and that's it. That's it. I could be in Paris today, tomorrow, anything I want. Like, maybe I'm hanging out at the community center with you folks. Super important. And yeah, Rhonda does not get, I guess we're just supposed to be happy. They got the center and Special K's there, so happy ending for all. Let's see. Do you recall the scene where Ozone and Turbo, they are, I guess, going over lessons, dating lessons, and they end up dancing and kind of fantasizing about both Kelly and this other non-white female? Do you remember that? And they end up kind of fighting each other and then dancing with each other. That almost kind of gave similar feel to Black Mirror a little bit. But just thoughts on that scene where they're fighting over this doll, reminisce or fantasizing about a white woman, and I would say a non-black, non-white female who is significantly lighter than them both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, in retrospect, I hadn't made that connection. I watched, the Breaking Tube first, and then I watched the Black Mirror last, but it has a very similar dynamic, and it's connected to other motivations of Turbo and Ozone throughout the movie, that they're both driven by their fantasies of being with these beautiful women, and particularly in the case of Kelly being with a white woman, that is a controlling motivation that may even bring them into conflict. Thinking about the way that Turbo even kind of calls Ozo out on this in the very first scene, he said they live in the garage, and you see Ozone is tidying up, and Turbo calls him out and says, Kelly's the only girl that you'll clean up for. Like, he wouldn't clean up if someone else is coming to visit. That, that brings out the person who's willing to clean up. In this scene that you talk about, that's played out comically, the way that these two young men are, so to speak, controlled or driven by these fantasy images, which aren't even there. I'll say another scene that maybe you're going to, that is, I've seen just as a clip. If you look it up, like a review of it, and the one clip was, do you recall the scene of the nurses dancing at the hospital? One of the kind of ridiculous episodes. It's one of the scenes where Turbo's been injured, but then they take his cast off and he's fine.
Right.
But it shows these beautiful white dancers dressed up as nurses, and you see them dance past a surgery that's taking place. And there's a black doctor who is the surgeon, and he's performing surgery. So on the one hand, you think, this is meaning to acknowledge, yes, black people have important professional roles, but it's immediately undercut, because as soon as these dancers come by, he just freaks out. He starts like having spasms, and it's supposedly played for laughs, but it shows him as being utterly kind of mesmerized or rendered. He's supposed to be performing surgery. What kind of portrayal is that, right? That that Earl Butz. I think that was Earl Butz you're talking about, Nixon.
Yes, sir.
Secretary, right?
Yes, sir.
Right. That this was one of those scenes that very much portrayed that image of the black man who's this professional surgeon, but he sees these women dancing and he just loses all sense of professionalism or dignity in that moment.
Yep. That's important detail from the scene. I was even going to take the clip, because that's that whole little tacky montage. It concludes with the segment. I think the white female nurse, as Turbo is sneaking out with the non-black, non-white female, she confronts her in the elevator, and the female, she responds in Spanish, and she says, "Why can't they hire people who speak Spanish?" It's like, oh man, that's boop. That would take us right to Terminator. Like, boop, great little segue, but I forgot to get the cut in, so I just have to say it. Let's see. Did I have? I think that was. I didn't have anything else for Breaking 2. Not bringing this out to minimize the violence and what have you, at all. Take it super serious. Just wow to pick a film, and even that component. I will say this: Dylann Roof said, "You're raping our women." To pick a film where that's kind of a central theme, black males chasing a white woman or white women in general. That is kind of interesting. I think we did talk about that before. I guess that would be my last. Any thoughts on that, them picking such a film? I mean, that's been a centuries-long rallying cry of white supremacists. The black males are coming to rape our women.
Yeah, that's the rallying call of lynching, you know, the lynch mob. That's the illusion or the fantasy of the black man who is there to violate the white woman. I mean, in some sense, portrayed as a more serious threat in something like the Terminator series. But you're right. That's also true of this movie, that there is that same kind of pursuit that's going on. I'll just say of many things that I shouldn't find it hard to believe, but one of the things I read in the newspaper recently was that Congress had, you know, introduced a proposal to make lynching a hate crime. You know, that tells you like the long history that we are still in. If lynching is not a hate crime, what is? And that is not yet on the books. It's something that's still happening.
We talked about that. I think there was white resistance even today to getting such legislation passed. And then we talked about Robert Fuller in California, the black male who was found hanging under suspicious circumstances that many believe is a lynching, and that just was from, you know, a few weeks ago. So system is ongoing. Let's see, so that's two down. The number is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, we're with University of Texas Austin professor Dr. Martin Kevorkian, author of Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America. How could we not discuss Terminator Dark Fate when that is one of the central components of the book? Let's see if I can get a nice quote. While I get a quote, did you see the commercial for the trailer for this movie that came out last summer? It featured the basketball player for the LA Clippers, Kawhi Leonard. Did you see? It was like a 30-second trailer to promote the film.
No, I did not. I did not see that. I saw another trailer that people complained about for all the wrong reasons, but I didn't see the Kawhi Leonard clip.
Oh, which trailer did you see that people complained about?
It was one that was featured prominently, the Mackenzie Davis character. And, you know, Mikara Davis, she plays Grace. She's the augmented human, and also Sarah Connor, and showing them doing all these kinds of heroic things. And this is sort of at the time when there was a lot of fanboy backlash, I think, you know, white nerd culture backlash against things like Star Wars and resenting that it had strong female characters. And there are people saying, oh, they're ruining the franchise by, you know, trying to make these women into these strong heroic characters. Well, it's just wrong on so many levels, but I mean, that's what the Terminator has always been, is about Sarah Connor defending herself against the relentless pursuit of the dark machine. It's always been that, and it shouldn't, I mean, in one hand, and the right, it shouldn't be mistaken as some sort of, I think, wonderful female empowerment, but it was weird that was what they were complaining about, that somehow Terminator Dark Fate had ruined the franchise by giving such big roles to women in fighting machines. That's what it's always been, is the white woman threatened by the machine.
Mm. just talking about that, I thought Turbo and Ozone trying to get Special K. I thought we just talked about that one. Wow, I did not know that there was, like, controversy about the, I guess, portrayal in that commercial about having these strong women leads. I did not, I didn't see that one. That's interesting. I'll pause for a second from the commercial I was talking about, though. I think it's super interesting just because I was thinking today, like, I think that is hogwash. Like, all of the talk about, oh, man, we don't have enough strong they're talking about white women leads generally. We don't have enough strong white women leads for these roles in Hollywood. And why can we get more white women leads? And I was thinking, man, like the most successful sci-fi franchises, I think by far in the last 50 years, Sigourney Weaver, Linda Hamilton, and Jennifer Lawrence. Hands down. Like, they got everybody. Hunger Games, Terminator, and I forgot my other film. Jennifer Lawrence, Linda Hamilton. Oh, Aliens. Aliens, hands down. Those are the most successful, and every one of those, it is a white woman. Sometimes they don't even have a gun who is leading the day. Generally, you talk about Aliens in the book. You talk about Terminator in the book. Hunger Games, this was out before Hunger Games, but it's generally a white woman fighting against some dark nemesis. But yeah, I totally reject that. Like, for the last 50 years, the world has had no problem in droves for lots of different generations going out and consuming films that have white women kicking butt and saving the world. The commercial that I was talking about with Kawhi Leonard, so he's the basketball star with the Clippers. So even before this movie came out, he has been talked about as, like, not having a lot of emotion, and he just doesn't do a lot of celebrating and such when he plays. He's won championships and stuff, and even then doesn't do a lot of celebrating. So they said, you know, he's machine-like, robotic, which even I think that is interesting because I generally don't hear white athletes described in that manner. It'll be they're cerebral. They strategize, not that they're machines. Generally, people don't say Tom Brady's a machine. They'll have other accolades, other descriptors. Kawhi Leonard, for years, in fact, they've called him a cyborg. They have an interview with him from, I think it was February of this year. It was right after the All-Star game, which is in February. But they were doing the interview, and they got to the end. And they were super congratulatory. He'd had a great game. They were, oh, that's great, Kawhi, blah, blah, blah. You are a cyborg. And he said, what? What did you call me? Because he, I guess, hadn't seen the film or whatever. They said, you know, like Terminator, you're a robot. You don't think. And he said, oh, okay. And he said, but that was in February of this year. But they've been doing that for a long time, calling him the Terminator and such. So for this commercial, they have Kawhi Leonard, and I think he's with another of his teammates, black male teammate. And they go out, and they're talking to Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton. I think it was just those two, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton. He's talking to them about the movie, and they're joking because, like I said, he's been known as a machine for a long time. And so they're joking with him, like, oh, are you really a robot? You know what they say? Is that true? Blah, 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 blah. And so they get to the end of the commercial, and he turns around, and he the joke, he has this kind of awkward laugh that makes him sound even more robotic to play into it. So he does his awkward laugh, and they give him the Terminator red eyes as he laughs, and the commercial fades out. And I said, oh, man, that's Dr. Cook. Black people are not humans, just machine, machine, machine. But, yeah, you said you hadn't even seen that commercial?
I have not. That is exactly what we've been talking about. And it's, again, it's sometimes, you know, the logic of it doesn't surprise you, but sometimes there are moments in culture when you talk about Anthony Mackie, meaning you get a better agent, that sort of thing. It's sort of amazing that, you know, even black people that we consider to be in positions of relative power find themselves in these kinds of representations. I know that, you know, it was, we talked, for example, about, you know, moments in like a movie like Training Day when you have an Academy Award winner like Denzel Washington, you know, given a line comparing himself to King Kong. And it seems like, yeah, that's been happening through the whole history of cinema, so it's nothing surprising, but it is surprising to see, you know, a Denzel Washington in that representation or to see Kawhi Leonard being treated as a robot to the point of being given machine eyes. It shows the extent of that logic.
And the confusion, like, I don't think most people would see that. Or I guess most people haven't read Color Monitors, mm-hmm. The Blackface of Technology in America. If you have read that book, that one would click immediately. So hopefully that's why I said this is not just picking films randomly. We'll pick up on some of this information. But just to read, because you talk about the Terminator franchise in your book, this is on page 30. Excuse me. In the iconic text of the production, still, we read the fruits of Dyson. So this is Michael Dyson, black male character, again, and he did the narration for Invisible Man. We did a whole program, Dr. Kevorkian, where we talked about Invisible Man, my favorite book ever. The fruit of Dyson's innocent devotion to his computer work, though partially obscured, the words on the shirt of John Connor, future leader of the human resistance, read, "Public enemy." According to the message sent from the future, Miles Dyson's research makes him public enemy number one. Public Enemy's breakthrough rap album, Fear of a Black Planet, touched upon a deep white phobia that the Terminator future horrifically realizes. For fear of a black planet, Dyson must be stopped. Linguistically and visually, the script and film make a direct connection between blackness and Dyson's technological advances. Sarah Connor's fear of what she calls the dark future. They make it so plain in the Terminator. Like, once you get an inkling that this might be about racism, like, wow, they do not leave any room for error. The new franchise is Terminator, Dark Fate. It's no guesswork at all. Like, oh, okay, got it, still same theme. Okay. Dark Future commits her to war against those who build the wrong machines. In a bit of description from the screenplay, when Dyson manages to tear himself away from the computer screen for a rare break, the exposition comments that, as no further progress will be made that day, the forces of darkness have lost this round. Well, so Terminator Dark Fate. I mean, the title, like, they let you know from the beginning that we're not deviating. The problem is still blackness. Yes, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, it's absolutely on the nose, and it's not just obviously it's in the title, but it's in the way that the frightening future is described again. There's a description right away of this, machine uprising apocalypse, and it says the children look like burnt paper, black, not moving. It's a future where everything has literally been turned black. Understood that, we're to understand that white children are at risk, are going to be burned in this future apocalypse. Later, when Danny, who's going to be the revolutionary woman, asks Grace, the white augmented woman, what happened? Everything went dark. That's her line. It's all about, and in that case, that's not everything went dark in the sense of being burned to a blackness, but that's about the power being unplugged. It's about when the machines that are designed to serve stop serving. When that power, when that system goes out, then you have the dark fate that the title is talking about, when the machines fight back against their status and turn off the lights. And I'll also say, just visually, even more than in other instances of the franchise, in some of them, like in Terminator 2, you had the sort of shapeshifter, shiny liquid metal Terminator who, under his illusory skin was kind of shiny metal. But here, like, even those shapeshifter Terminators, whenever they're struck, whenever their surface disappearance is disturbed in any way, you see blackness underneath the surface. and you've got, you know, Sarah Connor is the one who is consistently emphasizing this fear and hatred of these black machines. You know, when they meet Arnold's Terminator, the Danny woman said, wonders if this man can help us. And Sarah Connor writes, not a man. He's a Terminator. Shoot him in the face and see what's underneath. And this is a movie that's continually showing these machines that are infiltrators and that are black underneath. I think there's more to be said also in an early scene that is down in Mexico, where we have the brother and sister, Daniela and Danny. I guess it's actually in Guatemala, and we see it's Diego, goes to his work at a factory, and he says, there's a new guy at my station, and we look over, and it's a robot arm that is replacing the non-white workers with robotic workers. So there's right away, there's that interchangeability of forced labor that's built into that term robot. There's a new guy at my station, it's a robot, and it's a black and orange robot arm. Yeah, I was very struck by it, again, that the words, the darkness and blackness are used throughout, but they're also used visually throughout in such an emphatic way. Whenever the nature of the machine is being revealed, it's revealed as having being black in color.
I saw or I read reviews of this film where they described the Terminator as tar black. This edition. Wow, that's accurate though, because that's kind of visualization. But generally, I don't hear positive descriptions about something being tar black, unless we're talking about the road. Like, I mean, people getting tarred and feathered, like, there generally are not positive associations with tar or blackness. But just since we've been talking about names, right, we did Theo, we did Ozone, and Turbo, I had to pause for names because the lead female character in this film is named Danny, which was the name of the black male, not a man, in Black Mirror, Danny. I did want to point that out, that even he got a kind of name that can go both ways, because I do know quite a few females that go by Danny. Anyway. So we got our female lead in this one, Danny, who is being saved. She's supposed to be the force of the future. And Grace, the white woman. Names. What do we make of this white woman who is the... augmented. She's, you know, enhanced, where she can be fast and strong. I'm not sure if I think of her as a robot or... do I just think of her as a white woman? What do we make of her name, Grace? And then what do we make of hers? Are we to accept her as a white woman? Are we accept her as a robot? Or yes, what do we make of Grace?
Yeah, I did categorize that name, Grace, in that same sort of linguistic register of, you know, Trinity in the Matrix. Someone, you know, the white woman that's given the transcendent name, versus the more down-to-earth names, the workman-like names or the labor-like names. She is portrayed as a kind of a white savior figure, an agent of grace. And I'll confess, when I first saw her in action, I thought, oh, she's another one of those quote-unquote good Terminators, like that's been sent back, like, you know, not the Terminator 1, but the Terminator 2, Arnold, where he's sent to save them because he's been programmed. But the lines in the movie really double down and insist upon her humanness. Diego asks, are you a machine too? She says emphatically, no, I'm human like you, augmented. So it's a movie that wants to have this white female character who has this augmented tremendous strength that you would associate with, you know, with a machine, but at the same time really goes out of its way to emphasize that she gets to still have human status. And, you know, there's nothing about her machinery really that is associated, you know, visually or otherwise with blackness when she's injured, when she's repaired. The way that she's repaired primarily is through administering medicine, right? It's not like rewiring her or that kind of a thing. She's augmented, but she's also portrayed as organic and human when the movie goes out of its way to deny humanity to the other characters. Again, Sarah Connor going out of her way to say that, you know, the Arnold Terminator is not a man. It's a little different in this one. In Terminator 2, there's a sense that the good Terminator has been made good by being reprogrammed, right? So it's the idea that a machine that is controlled is okay. It's still a machine, but it's in control. You know, the idea of the under control slave versus the slave revolt that is the metaphor of the machine uprising. Here it's a little different. It's not that he's been reprogrammed by being taken captive, but in a sense he's been rewired by 20 years of taking care of someone else's children. He says he's learned how to become like a human. And he does this by really serving in that role of, you know, he's the machine that's been given to protect and raise this other woman's children. So again, that's I also say in terms of other things that we've talked about, it emphasizes that in the Terminator's relationship with this movie, with this woman, he raises her children, and he has to explain, my relationship with her is not physical. I am very reliable. So he kind of downgrades himself. He's saying, I'm not having this physical, loving relationship, but I'm serving her. And that's how I get to have something closer to human status, by being a good robot, being a good Terminator.
That's such an important, well, that both of those, they're such key points. Grace, she does not turn black. She is not contaminated with darkness. When she gets injured, she still bleeds, and as she said, she needs medicine, you know, something that I need, humans, you know, can take to repair themselves. And then for Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator, he says it, our relationship is not physical. It reminds me of Black Mirror, and what you said about James Baldwin, mm-hmm. Neutralized. I'm no sexier, not a threat. I don't even have genitals, in fact. So nothing physical. I just serve. And in fact, Mr. Fuller talks about the eunuch. He's in that same clip, in the same interview that I started with. He talks about it later on, that if you are a black male and you are a eunuch, you're not active sexually, you're not defined. You can hang out, no problem, be well served. But any of that where you might be ozone turbo looking like you're interested, get out of here. Man, oh man, we were supposed to talk about this point especially. Now, I did not even recognize Mackenzie Davis. That is Black Mirror, San Junipero. We just talked about that film not that long ago, and so important. We had a sound clip and everything. She had the line, will you help me? I have said that for a decade on this program, that one of the things we have to do, stop helping white people. That is one of the ways we will work against racism, white supremacy. How apocalyptic have things become in Terminator Dark Fate? Mackenzie Davis volunteers to go back and help a non-white person. And in fact, she has to lecture this non-white. She has to give her the Gus T. Renegade lecture. I almost made it a sound clip. She tells her, hey, she hops out of the helicopter to go rescue Linda Hamilton, Sarah. She says, what are you doing? She is not important. Leave her alone. It doesn't matter. And she says, what? She says, you are important. If you die, everyone in the future dies. It is not. She's not important. You cannot be helping her. And they have the screenshot. They show Linda Hamilton, who looks so hurt and disgusted. Oh, she's right. And she pouts a little bit, and nobody even says anything. What to make of that? I said that's what we need to do to stop ending racism, and things have been totally flipped on their head. How did we go from San Junipero, I need you to help me, to don't you help that white woman, even if she dies?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of characters that are, you know, required to sacrifice themselves in order to save Danny, the non-white woman who is the important thing. And it even also goes out of its way to say it's not just that she's going to have the equivalent of John Connor of the future. She's not going to give birth to a heroic man, that she herself is the hero. Before Grace, the Mackenzie Davis character at the end, sacrifices herself to save Danny, the only woman, the only human, you know, who matters, who has to survive. Carl who's the name for Arnold's, you know, good Terminator. Although, specifically talking about names, Linda Hamilton, the Sarah Connor character, says, I'll never call you Carl. She refuses to give him a name. She refuses to give him a human name. He's always the T-800. Anyhow, he sacrifices himself, and he says, I'm doing it for John. He says, for John. That's his signature line in this movie. He does everything for the memory of this white boy, and he sacrifices himself. And then Grace also sacrifices herself. But there's a loophole at the very end, because what Danny says last, her last words about that is, I won't let her die for me again. So there's this plot that's been put in motion where Grace, the white woman, comes and gets to be the self-sacrificing savior for this non-white woman who's going to save humanity. But there's the promise that on some future timeline that Danny is going to repay Mackenzie Davis's Grace character. She's ultimately going to save her. So it's like the white woman in this hero gets to have her cake and eat it too. She gets to be the self-sacrificing savior, but then the person that she saves is also now going to be tasked with going and saving her. So she will, we get the idea that she's going to be brought back at the end.
Paying her debt, so to speak. But I think that's a... That is rather significant, if that is in any way tied to, oh my, the darkness has taken over and white supremacy, white power has fallen, and somehow in that fall, now we are no longer helping white people. It has been reversed. In fact, and we are instructing the non-white people to not help. Like, wow. When I was telling listeners that we were going to talk about this film, Thomas in New York said, are you talking about the Mexican Terminator? And I said... What? And I took a few moments and I said, oh, wait a minute, they do go to Mexico. And I guess, yeah, I guess they're Mexican. So I guess, yeah, that would be the Mexican Terminator. We talked about the blackness, but I mean, they could have had a white character. This fella, they land in Mexico. And then when he arrives at this time period and he goes to speak, he starts speaking Spanish. What is being communicated? What sort of messaging are they, I mean, just with everything, the location, they're hopping the border to try to get in the country. Like, what is going on? What are they communicating here?
Yeah, I mean, I thought in the setting that they were emphasizing this continuity or this kind of interchangeability between a particular labor force and the robots. I mean, there's the the idea that the maquiladoras, the machine workers, that, you know, a lot of cheaply available goods are dependent upon the labor that is outsourced from, you know, white, you know, from white businesses to places like Mexico or places in South America where the labor is cheaper. And so for him to be an infiltrator in that setting, he takes on that guise where he's both the robot and the looks like the non-white laborers. He also, it allows him to, played by Gabriel Lynn, it allows him to infiltrate. He also takes on the guise of a non-white woman at one point when he's infiltrating Border Patrol. And he ends up in that guise of the non-white woman killing a black man, guy who just wanted to eat donuts, that you know, Mexican or Latino Terminator impersonates a non-white woman, and then kills the black drone operator. So the black man there was also already associated with this kind of remote technological control. I'm not sure I'm making a very, very clear point here, but I felt like there was a grouping of drone operation, factory work, factory workers that all clustered around representations of non-white sectors of the world.
That makes sense. Well, I guess I'll play a sound clip and ask this way. There are, to me at least, the character Gabriel, the Terminator, non-white person, I think a non-white person. He's speaking Spanish and a little darker than most individuals who'd be classified as white. But there is some racial ambiguity here, because he has a scene after the prison break. He misses on being able to kill Danny. They get away, and so he's talking to some of the police officers. They're coming to try to figure out what happened. So he talked. Now, most of the film, he's got his Spanish accent. He's speaking, you know, fluid Spanish. In fact, that's the way I just said. When he first arrives at this time period, he pops out. He's speaking Spanish. Now, you go in and you listen to him in this scene. This is what he sounds like.
Hey there, fellas. Y'all come to see the shit show? What the hell happened here? Detainee got loose, unlocked all the cages, just chaos from there. I don't mind telling you, I prayed more in 5 minutes than I have my whole life.
Heard that.
Say, you boys know where I can get my hands on a chopper.
And he's so good, he gets the chopper. But I mean, you got that scene there. Drops that accent. I mean, the Terminators have been able to do the voice thing before, but I mean, that scene, at least to me, that seems like you want to talk about code switching, like, wow. We talk about racial ambiguity. Is there something being conveyed in that scene?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is another scene that emphasizes the distrust and fear that Sarah Connor is always peddling when in the presence of Terminators. Like, she will never trust, the Carl Arnold character, because she places such an emphasis that Carl is an infiltrator who is deceiving to fit in. And again, it seems like a distrust or a fear of someone who is able to pass. He's saying, Arnold's character being able to pass as human is hiding something about him. And I think in this same way, the scene in which the Gabriel character slips into that good old boy accent is meant to kind of confirm that sort of distrust or fear that Sarah Connor has explicitly expressed around infiltration or passing or code switching, pretending to be human, pretending to be someone who is on the side of control, when really you're on the side of the machine slave uprising.
Passing. Let's see. the... talked about the tar. I had written that down as well. The black people, even when they have the break at the detention center, I think it's when he goes specifically, it seems like, to make sure he kills the black guard and then, you know, kills a lot of the other folks. But I don't even believe there are. I think there are like three black characters in this film total, and they all die. You mentioned he kills.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the other one that I really noticed was the black officer who supplied the EMT to Sarah Connor. Like, Sarah Connor says, yeah, I know a guy. And this is the guy who, he only exists to hook her up with this technology. So he is the connection to the machine that she's going to use against the machines. And he takes the first bullet. But one of the, I thought, Major Dean is the character. But he also says really specifically, he says, you know, Sarah, I don't commit treason for just anyone. So he's a black man who's willing to sacrifice, break all kinds of laws, get in all kinds of trouble for the white woman. So again, that.
Yeah. Important point. Very much like Michael Dyson's character from Judgment Day. I'm just here to sacrifice my life and throw it all away for this white woman. And the specialness of the white woman, even when they're at the detention facility, they separate her from all the other non-white people, presumably. She says, oh, you get your own special cage. And they take her away where, even though she's a criminal and wanted, she's still going to be separated from the other non-white people. Like, the preservation of the white woman is pretty ubiquitous. What do we make, if anything, of the future in where this one, it's like these Terminators, they're tar black, but they're different. They are more organic. They grow. I mean, it seems like a lot of their kills are not with, like, machinery and guns like the old Terminator. Arnold Schwarzenegger, he would just have guns and, you know, if he could grab you and all that, but most of the time you just have lots of guns and, you know, shoot people down. These, it's like they just grow lots, almost, it's almost like alien phallic symbols that they kind of just grow and just oh, I forgot a black character. It was a black character. She was a nurse who saves Grace when she's almost going to die after being stabbed by one of the future AI creatures. It's a black nurse where she volunteers, and I guess they give her the, I guess maybe she lives, maybe, I don't know, but that's the only other black character I can think of in the film, and all the other black characters die generally very quickly. But what do we make of the drastic change in the phenotype and just the movements and operations of these specific Terminators in Dark Fate?
Yeah, I hadn't reflected on that, but you're right. I mean, they're always growing these, you know, protuberances that are used to slash and stab. There's a little bit of that in Terminator 2 with the, you know, the shiny metallic guy, but much more of it here. And I'm not entirely convinced of my own reaction to this or about, you know, other things I am attempting to interpret here, but. You know, I think a little bit of the way that there are ethnic associations of certain levels of who has guns and who has knives, like the line from the Untouchables, where, you know, Sean Connery is the, you know, heroic Irish cop who is, you know, how the Irish became white, has become white by, you know, being the good cop, and he's mocking the Italian gangster, and he uses an ethnic slur and says, it's, you know, it's just like an Italian to bring a knife to a gunfight. That there is this hierarchy here where this new kind of Terminator in this, you know, Mexican South American context has very much the resources of knives, whereas just over the top, Sarah Connor has guns, big guns. So it's a way of differentiating between her style of fighting and the kind of power that she wields, and then the people who don't have guns, but who fight in these other dangerous and devious shape-shifting ways.
devious, the infiltrators. They're so deceptive. The last point I'll get in before we shove off our The Hate U Give, our last film. It seems like there might be some messaging to white audiences with this film. Arnold Schwarzenegger is pretty old at this point. Linda Hamilton, she's in her 60s at this point, I think 65. There was a review written by David Edelston. He writes, Dark Fair has gotten much better reviews than it deserves, but I understand why people want to embrace it. The stars of the first big wave of sci-fi action blockbusters, Schwarzenegger, Hamilton, Harrison Ford, and his fellow Star Wars icons are at an age, all white people, are at an age when they can collect Social Security, and their passing of the torch, especially to young women, honors the past while pointing toward a more just, equal society. I don't know about that last part there, but it does seem, and particularly, I'll get in a quick sound clip because they have specific messaging to white people in this film. When they're trying to escape and making their trek to cross the border, Danny is fussing at them. This is like 20 seconds. We'll hear what they say as Danny is fussing at them as they try to trek through Mexico.
This is off the grid, all right. But I wish it wasn't so crowded here.
Well, I wish you two weren't so white.
And they go to try to hop the train to get across the border. But that's kind of rare in my experience for that white, being classified as white, to be expressed as a problem in a film. And Terminator, Dark Fate, things are not going well for white people. In fact, it's so bad it's even a problem for them to try to hide and camouflage in this situation, not or being white. And then, as I said, the two main white star, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton, they're aged and, you know, no longer the spry athletes that they were back when this whole franchise started. And they have talked quite a bit about that, white people aging in this area of the world, and maybe we might be dependent on getting more non-white people, younger non-white people, to immigrate to this part of the world. The future might be dependent on so-called Dannies and such. Is there some messaging being communicated to white people about, you know, their status or jeopardy?
Yeah, no, I've written down that line and puzzled over it, and I thought it was striking that it did include it. I mean, its significance might be limited in one sense to just, okay, they're out of their element, and so, you know, she wishes they weren't that white because they need to blend in, as you say. But yeah, that could be messaging that is an increasing world situation, and it's an increasing American situation. So I hadn't seen that, but I think that could very well reflect that anxiety of an older generation, and, you know, maybe a hope of a certain kind of passing of the torch, but one which, you know, you rightly are skeptical of whether it's more just.
I'm skeptical. This will be my last clip, last send-off before we get to The Hate U Give. I'm skeptical because I look at what's been happening. I've been telling folks all year long, with even before we got to the protests this year, armed white people. That's been the theme of 2020, one of the major themes. Even before we got to the protests, it was armed white people out in the streets. I'm mad about the Rona, and I'm mad about the lockdown. I'm mad you're not going to tell me that I have to wear a mask. You're not going to tell me I have to stay home. There were white gun shop owners in South Carolina who were suing and saying that they did, there was no constitutional right to mandate that they shut down. This has been pretty widespread throughout the year, and then it's just escalated almost exponentially with the protests. Now it's white people out in the street with guns for all kinds of reasons. The looters, the protests, the virus, the lockdown, like all kinds of reasons. That's theme of the year, armed white people. They've had so many reports within all of that. It started in about March or April when things got serious with the virus. Increasing gun sales. They had those reports for about a month and a half. Increasing gun sales. Increasing gun sales. Increasing ammunition sales. All throughout, not just in one region. And then that was followed by even more white people out in public with guns. And they had all these reports about runs to gun stores. This is my last clip from Terminator that very much resonated with what's happening right now.
Okay. What weapons? You just keep this around?
Even without a rogue AI taking over, I calculated a 74% chance that human civilization will collapse into barbarism. In the dead eventuality, these weapons will be vital to protect my family. Also, this is Texas.
He's preparing for the Boogaloo, too. I think there's something to be said about that. That spirit constantly being there, the gotta have those guns, bad things are going to be happening, gotta be prepared, have your the great equalizer for the dark fate.
Yeah, no, I mean, it, as you said, the theme of armed white people is the theme of the Boogaloos. I mean, in a way, it kind of plays it off at the end. It becomes a Texas joke, but the reality of that joke is not funny, of people arming and arming because of that idea of that, you know, when he said they calculate 74% chance of descent into barbarity, with the family unit being the one that's going to be protected by that massive armament.
Context of white supremacy. Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing, she said, if you do not under, or she said, you won't understand gun mania if you don't understand white supremacy. Very important point. Our last offering. Oh my goodness. Woo! I am excited. Wow. Wow. We read this here book in the book club. Some time back. In fact, we read this book. This was, for a time, the worst book I've ever read. Wow, it's so much I could say about the book. My goodness. So we read the book, and we read the book before the movie came out, even though we were seeing, like, oh, the film is about to come out and all of that. So, oh, this will be a great little study guide, because I'm very aware that many people have, many schools, this book is required reading. Even before all the protests and everything that happened this year, this book was required reading. This book, someone told me that they saw the movie, but they didn't even know the book existed, which I thought was incredible, because the book was on the New York Times young adult bestseller list for over 50 weeks, and it's probably going to be back there again now because it's being recommended so much. The book and the movie, that people check it out, and oh my goodness, if you want to help your children understand the protest and what's happening right now, The Hate U Give, and they have it streaming. They have this book. They didn't make Terminator Dark Fate free on Amazon, but they made The Hate U Give free on Amazon. You can stream it, watch it at your leisure, and I think some other platforms. They made it free along with some other. Dr. Kevorkian was talking about the suggested viewings from Netflix. All I can say is this book, formerly the worst book ever. Oh man. If you were going to explain the movie to someone who hadn't seen it, if you were going to give them a synopsis, what would your explanation be, Dr. Kevorkian?
I guess, yeah, I have some thoughts about the relationship of the movie to the book. I think you know, maybe you're setting this up or saying it was the worst thing, and you know, probably until you saw the movie, because I think there are some things, there are moments in the book that you could take out and talk about as perhaps having some value to them, and but that are undermined even more in the movie. But yeah, it is a movie that focuses on the drama of a young black woman named Star, 15 years old. who is the witness to a completely unprovoked police shooting of a black man, that she is riding along with her friend since childhood. And it's about her going through the decisions of, you know, how is she going to find her voice? How is she going to testify? How is she going to try to get justice for her friend, Khalil? And I'll say, you know, that's one of the things that I've seen that the author, Andy Thompson, wrote about the book that I thought had value. She wrote an afterword at some point that said, names have power. And I think this is a story that believes that and emphasizes that. And one of the things is Khalil means friend. But, I mean, I guess if I could summarize what I want to say about the difference between the movie and the book. The other thing is it's very, a very important character in this book is Star's father, and a man by the name of Maverick, played in the movie by Russell Hornsby. You know, I think his performance is very strong here. He's someone who is teaching his children about the dangers of police stops, but also really in a more educational sense is teaching them about the principles, the 10-point Black Panther power principles. But the essence of what happens in the movie that I think undermines even the purpose of the title is, you know, the title is called The Hate U Give. And this is taken, it's explained several times in the book that this is taken from, you know, The Hate U Give Little Infants Messes Up Everyone. It's an acronym that it's from Thug Life. The father talks a lot about that. When his daughter says it's not just about youth, it's about all of us. It's about the ways that white society denies opportunity to non-white people, and about the consequences of that. But the thing that, you know, I thought was maybe most surprising in the changes is that this theme of the hate you give and the idea of the consequences of hatred or neglect or lack of opportunity that is given to non-whites as having these consequences. The movie adds a scene in which the main character, Star, says finally at the end, it's not about the hate you give, it's about the hate, it's the hate we give. I'm sure Mr. Renegade is going to say more about, again, that idea you brought up at the beginning, that Anthony Mackie needs to get better roles. But Anthony Mackie plays a character named King, who is straight up cast as the villain and really the kind of substitute villain. You would think, based on the way it starts, that okay, it's going to be a movie about you know, the terrible police system and police brutality, and the real villain is going to be the cop. By the spirit of means have power, when the game starts, she won't name the police officer. She always just calls him 115. So you think he's going to be the villain, and the purpose of the book is going to be to bring him to justice. But in the end, it's King, played by Anthony Mackie, who is shown to be a terrible father, an abusive spouse, someone who's a drug dealer, and someone who, in the end, he is the one that comes to be blamed for the problems of the community. There's even a line that probably says, the cops took down King thanks to the whole community. So, I mean, you know, the thing that's set up about that it should be about the takedown of the cops, in the end, the cops come back and are supposedly helping the community by taking this man as Anthony Mackie out of circulation. And so when it's changed from The Hate U Give, The Hate U Give is about taking responsibility on a system of white supremacy. That would be my understanding of what that that Sam used to say. But then in the end, Star shifts it. It's about the hate we give. It comes to blame everything that is wrong, maybe not everything, but much of it is wrong, on characters like King, who must be brought to justice.
All righty, that's a good summary, good starting point. We talked a lot about names. The name King, what do you make of the name? And they do reference Dr. King in the book, not the film, to my recollection. But Dr. King is mentioned in the book, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. What do you make of the substitute villain? It's a great way to describe it. The substitute villain, black male character King, or that being his name in this book. What would be your interpretation of that?
I'll puzzle about that. I mean, I don't think it was meant to be a reference to Dr. Martin Luther King. He's King because he's head of the King Lords. It's one of the kind of, I would say, ambivalences of the story, that on the one hand, in the book, you have a black man who have power, and Maverick is a powerful character, and he enlists the help of some of the other King Lords, even to protect his family, by the way, which doesn't happen in the movie, that he takes steps to protect his family, by surrounding himself with allies, black men who will help protect his family, and his family, I would say, an extended source. But I think there's also then this kind of blame of the big man of the community, the King Lord, someone who presumes to have too much power. So in making him the substitute villain and having him be the King of the King Lords, it seems to undermine a certain kind of assertion of power or authority.
I've pondered on it some time myself, just since we've talked a lot about names, and particularly in the context of this text and how substitute villain is a black male named King.
Yeah.
I have to think about. Oh, did you have more?
No, I did not. Sorry.
Yeah, I have to ponder on that some more, particularly in the greater context of the story, and even I would say the greater treatment of black males within the text. I will play one sound clip. This is verbatim from the book, so this is one thing that they didn't change. This scene, this is towards closer to the end of the book. At this point, Star. Her white boyfriend, Chris Cowbell, they are going to be with Seven. He's her half-brother. He's been beaten up by King, who's no longer at the house, but he's going to come back. And Aisha, this is a black female, she's there. She's Seven's mother. And so she'll come in, you'll hear her later. But so Star, the main character, her white boyfriend, Chris, they're going in. They're going to see, oh, man, Seven's been beat up, blah, blah, blah. The conversation will go from there. But my question is going to be, since this is a scene in the film and this scene is directly in the book verbatim, my question to Dr. Gavorkian is going to be, so since this book is being heavily recommended right now, do you think white people would read a book like this and say, we should not practice racism. Let's do something to help black people and fight against the system of white supremacy. Do you think that would be their thought process after reading a book like this? So we're here, the sound clip, and remember, this is exactly in the book, so it doesn't matter. Read the book or you watch the film, you're going to get this scene. This is The Hate You Give.
Star, what are you doing here?
We're hurting.
Y'all leave before King comes back. He's looking for you.
Nah, Seven, we're leaving. Come on, help me out. Come on, let's go. Aisha, what happened?
What happened? You snitched.
and earned an ass whooping. My baby took it for you. Bleeding all on my floor and shit. Get him out of here. Take Kenya and Lyric with you too. Lyric? What? Y'all bothering me. Trying to get my drink on and shit. Go! King back. Yo, come on, go out the back door.
Aisha, thank you.
And they scurry out the back door. Children, mind you, these children scurry out the back door from King, the black male substitute villain. So, do you think white people would see or read content like this and think, man, we need to stop mistreating black people. Let's work to replace white supremacy with justice. Do you think that would be the response of white people reading or viewing content like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think increasingly over the course of the book, like less and less, like you could chart it, like it starts out and you think it's going to be a setup to motivate that kind of thinking or a call for justice. But by the end, and you know, the scene that, you know, you play is pretty close to the end. The focus has shifted to, you know, placing, you know, black people's problems at the feet of black people. And again, maybe that's the logic of the book too. And the screen adaptation is just noticing that in flipping from the hate you give to the hate we give, you know, sort of a self-condemnation by that, by the black community in that book. But I mean, I will say that, you know, Star has to kind of have explained her in the book that Aisha is, when she does that thing about, you know, get out of here, I got to get my drink on. She, at that moment, the woman, Aisha, is not being irresponsible. She's playing off like she doesn't care about them, but she's actually caring for them by sending them away. So there is, a gesture of strength and heroism on her part, but again, then it's all the weight of the blame is being carried by the King character, by Anthony Mackie's character in that scene. I will say that there is, it's verbatim, but there's one detail, not pertaining to what is said, but to the characters that are involved. There's a completely different character in the book named Devante. And in the book, Devante is not related to, it's not Seven who takes the beating, but it's Devante who takes the beating from King in this. The other children also have to be protected. But Devante is someone who Maverick has taken an interest in protecting and helping and doing good things for, and showed that he has a program of empowerment of the community that goes beyond just his family. So I think in the movie, it sort of narrows his world down to defending his family. In the book, it's about him also helping Devante, who's gotten caught up, you know, in King's business. But whether it's about Seven or whether it's about Devante, it's still the case at this point, to speak straight into your question directly, that the problems that are being portrayed are still now being portrayed as problems of the black community, to be caused by someone like King and to be solved by someone like Maverick, but not something that is calling for the change in the system of white supremacy, that the beginning injustice of the murder of Khalil would seem to have called for.
Context of white supremacy. Man, oh man, this, let's see, I'll do it this way. There are many reasons. I'll read a portion from the book because there are lots of things that they took out of the book. That's the case, I understand, with any book that gets adapted to a film. You know, you can't take everything from the book to the film, but I found it very interesting, a number of the things that they took out of the book, that I thought, you know, just further emphasized what a horrible book this is, that kind of reinforces what you said, like we have totally shifted the focus here completely from the system of white supremacy and white people killing black people to just have this focus on black people and make fun of black people and kind of say, hey, black people just make their own problems and that type of thing. Even to the point about Maverick, and this is something that we talked about a lot in the book club, because the author, Angie Thomas, she said in an interview that Maverick is her favorite character with a lot of pride. And I said, oh, okay. And I knew that as we began reading the book, so I kept that in mind. I said, wow, really? This is your favorite character? Like, woo! Like, same thing I said for Anthony Maggie. Like, wow, he does not get great treatment in the book. Now, it changes substantially to the movie, but not enough. They left out a lot of things, but I would just go to the book. So, Chris and Maverick, Star's father, only meet one time in the movie. They meet several times in the book, and they totally change the dynamics of their meeting, which is why I said, oh, wow, I felt championship, because I said, man, I'm just looking at the way this book is written. Like, I said, worst book ever. Who would celebrate this? So this is the scene that they totally excised, where Maverick finds out that his daughter Star is in a tragic arrangement with a white boy. So it reads, get over, oh, and this is he's talking to his wife. Get over it, Maverick. He's white. Mama shouts on the patio. White, white, white. Chris blushes and blushes and blushes and blushes. I hand him a juice box. That's why Devante was looking at you that way. You're white. Okay, he says, more than says, is this one of those black things I won't understand? Okay, babe, real talk. If you were somebody else, I'd side-eye the shit out of you for calling it that. Calling it what? A black thing? Yeah. But isn't that what it is? Not really, I say. It's not like this kind of stuff is exclusive to black people, you know? The reasoning may be different, but that's about it. Your parents don't have a problem with us dating? I wouldn't call it a problem, Chris says, but we did talk about it. So it's not just a black thing then, huh? Point made. We sit at the counter, and I listen to his play-by-play of school today. Nobody walked out because the police were there waiting for any drama. Haley and Maya asked about you, he says. I told them you were sick. They could have texted me and asked themselves. I think they feel guilty about yesterday, especially Haley. White guilt. He winks. I crack up. My white boyfriend talking about white guilt. Mama yells, and I love how you insist on getting somebody else's child out of Garden Heights, but you want ours to stay in that hellhole. You want them in the suburbs with all this fake shit? Daddy says, if this is fake, baby, I'll take it over real any day. I'm sick of this. The kids go to school out here. I take them to church out here. Their friends are out here. We can afford to move, but you want to stay in that mess? 'Cause at least in the Garden Heights, people ain't gonna treat them like shit. They already do. And wait until King can't find Devante. Who do you think he's gonna look at? Us. I told you I'll handle that, Daddy says. We ain't moving. It ain't even up for discussion. Oh, really? Really. Chris gives me a bit of a smile. This is awkward. My cheeks are hot, and I'm glad I'm too brown for it to show. Yeah, awkward. He takes my hand and taps his fingers against my fingertips one at a time. He laces his fingers through mine, and we let our arms swing together in the space between us. Daddy comes in and slams the door behind him. He zeroes straight in on our joined hands. Chris doesn't let go. Point for my boyfriend. We'll talk later, Star. Daddy marches out. If this were a rom-com, Chris said, you'd be Zoe Solanda and I'd be Ashton Kutcher. Huh? He sips his juice. This old movie. Guess who? I caught it when I had the flu a few weeks ago. Zoe Salonda and Ashton Kutcher. Her dad didn't like that she was seeing a white guy. That's us. I'll stop right there. So that would be the second illustration in this broadcast where a movie or this scene isn't in the movie. So a book is suggesting that black people are racist against white people. I told you that one is very common. But when they take out an entire scene, like, I know everything can't go in the movie, but I mean, wow, they have a whole lot of scenes like this where Maverick gets totally emasculated in the book. White children, his wife, thrown down on the ground in front of his children, family, like all kind of business burned down. Like, it's hard in the book to find a scene. Like, they have the scene after he gets thrown on the ground, and he comes back and he talks to his children. He says, "Star, what's the Black Panther 10-point program?" And encouraging her, like, speak up. That is not in the book in that manner. Like, it's tons of scenes like this where Maverick just, nobody listens to him. His wife doesn't listen to him. We're moving. We're going to testify without a like, nothing that he wants to do. Just everybody, just, nah, get out of here, get out of here. Like, the Maverick character in the book is nothing like what they portray in the film. Just, can you comment just on scenes like this being excised, and even your thoughts about this scene, because this is important in this context. You have a white child in your house. I don't know if you're a parent or not, but in your house, first time you're meeting him, holding your daughter's hand, all of this, and no flinch, no comment, no none of that. You're just meeting this fella. Like, wow, that's a man. That's a father, since we talked about that before, black fathers. Thoughts on the passage and then why a scene like this would be taken out of the film?
Yeah, thank you. You know, for book club folks who are following around it along, I think that's pages 230 to 233 in the book. And, I mean, there's just... the word awkward came up several times. I think, you know, it does emphasize the awkwardness of the scene and the way it's constructed. But, you know, of the, what you call kind of the emasculating gestures, rightly. I mean, there's something sickening about the moment, specifically when she says, "Point for my boyfriend," right? That she's kind of reveling, this character is reveling in, this, you know, this punk kid coming in and, you know, showing up her father, scoring a point against her father. That struck me as particularly sad amidst a lot of things that are troubling. As you say, it is exactly one of these scenes that tries to flip the tables and say, oh, look at how black people can be racist too. I'll say it mentions in the, along there, you know, Haley, who is another one of her terrible friends from the school. Haley is a white girl. I think, you know, Haley is kind of another, you know, a true villain, but also a substitute villain. I mean, there's another version of this book. I mean, in my head, I'm saying here, not the one that was printed or filmed. But, you know, Louise Carter, the mom, Star's mom, gives Star this kind of good talking to about her friend Haley and saying, look, if the bad things outweigh the good things, or even if just there are bad things you can't accept, you don't need to be her friend. And it seems to me that, you know, if the main character had taken that principle from her mother and applied it to Chris, she would have come to the same conclusion. And there's a moment pretty late on in the book where it seems like she has finally done that calculation. Like, it's just not worth it. I'm, you know, this is not a good guy. This is not a thoughtful guy. This is, and at the very moment when they're kind of at their lowest, they almost hook up physically right at that moment. In this particular scene, though, I do take to be very different, as you say, from the book is the negative way it portrays Maverick. One of the ways that Maverick is given more of a voice in the movie is that, the book starts with Star at a party and feeling out of place and trying to decide which person she should be. The movie starts in the neighborhood and then with Maverick giving a speech. And so I do want to give particularly some credit to the gravity and seriousness with which Russell Hornsby portrays that character and communicates some of the principles that he's trying to at the very beginning. But you're right. A scene like this from the book very much undermines that authority that is the author claims for, you know, the favorite character, and who I think in the movie is the favorite character.
What do you make of, and you mentioned Haley and Maya, these are some of Star's classmates at her ritzy and well-to-do white school, where I believe she's the only black person, or like one, her and a couple other folks. So Haley is the white girl who makes the comments about fried chicken and ends up being accused of being racist later on as they go through their little tacky arrangement. Maya, in the book, is portrayed as Asian, and they have this minority alliance, they call it, at one point, where she also speaks up about times where she's been a victim of racism and they've said racist things to her and that sort of thing. So they talk about this in the book. All that gets extra. Like I said, I know they can't put everything that's in the book and the film. I totally get it. But what do you make of the casting? Amanda Sandberg, I mentioned The Hunger Games before, Jennifer Lawrence. Amanda Sandberg was in that, and she faced a lot of racism. I remember that. People were very upset about her being cast as Rue, and what do we have this nigger in the movie, and you're messing it up, or even though she dies, what do we have her in the for, and blah, blah, blah. And I remember they had English classes where they had to stop and go back and read and see, is Rue really a black person in the book? And they looked and said, oh, man, she is a black person. Oh, okay, I guess they casted it right. But anyway, Amanda Sandberg has a white parent and a non-white parent. She is the lead cast for Star. That information is not in the book. The Star does not have a white parent and a non-white parent. So phenotypically, she is very much lighter than all of the other black characters in the movie. They also cast Maya's character, who is an Asian female in the book, Asian child. They cast her as a non-white person with a white parent. So she, I mean, at times I was like, well, is she a white person? And I had to go look at her bio and everything. It's like, oh, okay, she has one white parent and a non-white parent. So what do we make of that, if anything, that two of these characters, two of the important non-white roles in this film, and the lead role, non-white people with a white parent?
Yeah, I did notice that about the casting of Star. Be frankly different than what I had, you know, imagined from the book. I hadn't noticed really the difference in Maya. I think I just accepted that. I don't know how much it's a PR thing that, you know, in some of the descriptions, like if you go on the Internet Movie Database and you look up and they talk about the backgrounds of the different actors, that they will say, you know, about Amanda, like that she's got a Danish father, but partly from Greenland, and so there's some Inuit or some indigenous. So I feel like there's choices. I mean, that's not something that's legible if you're just watching the movie, but I feel like there were maybe emphasis in some of the casting to portray whiter characters, but also pick ones about whom it could be said that a certain kind of indigenous identity could be pointed to. Certainly the case with casting KJ Apa as Chris, and that was a substitute casting, that they had a white actor who was set to play Chris, and some footage surfaced of him using a racial slur, and so they fired him from the movie. They had to reshoot scenes with KJ Apa, and, you know, if you look him up on the movie database, it'll tell you that, you know, his father, even his name Apa might suggest his father is Samoan, and so he's portraying a white, you know, an all-white character from a privileged white school, but they're picking an actor about whom it can be said, well, look, there's an indigenous heritage there. That's something that you hear people talking about various, you know, counting in indigenous identity as part of a people of color grouping. For the star character, I don't know if they're going for this or not, but it is also, it is true in the book that from the very beginning, she's someone who has a divided consciousness, who does code switching and who tries to live in two worlds and feels terrible about it, that she lives, you know, there's Williamson Starr who tries to fit in at this rich white school, and then there's, you know, Starr who works at Maverick's Market, who is a neighborhood who does not sort of filter her speech. Perhaps that's one thing that they were going for in such a casting.
That could be. I do know that there are a lot of black people who are dark complexion, substantially darker than her, who have talked about their experience having to code switch. I know we read Leonida McCling, her book, A Foot in Each World. She was a journalist for the Chicago Tribune, and she talked about the same thing. I'm not sure she used the language of code switch, but I mean, the title says it all, A Foot in Each World. She talked about that, and I think that's been experienced for a lot of non-white people, not even just black people. So I don't know if you would... It's been my experience a lot of times that there's a pattern of casting. If we're going to cast someone as a lead, particularly for, I think, black female roles, if we're going to cast them for a lead, or they're going to be really important, if they're not going to be acting a fool, electric boogaloo, being goofy and that sort of thing, if they're going to be smart, using their brain, that type of thing, less dark. That tends to be a pattern I've observed, unfortunately. I think we've even seen it. I think they had the biopic on Nina Simone, and I think they did the same. I think they might have cast Zoe Saldana, who was just mentioned, who has a white parent. And some people kind of raised the same eyebrow, but in my view, that's an aspect of racism, white supremacy. And you can't even have black people represent black people for a role where this character had two black parents, as opposed to getting someone who phenotypically looks like they have two black parents. We pick someone who, you're going to be smart, we'll get someone who is a little bit closer to what we have labeled intelligence. You'll have the one white parent or one non-black parent, and then maybe you can have one black parent. But I could be off in my analysis, although I do not think so, with the book in general being formally the worst book ever. One reason among many, the word racism is in this book one time. The word normal, and this is the book that's being recommended right now. I'm sure it's back on the New York Times bestseller list, young adult bestseller list, again, already spent like 60 weeks there. But the word racism is in this book one time. The word normal is in this book 41 times. Now I'm going to read one more scene that's not in the movie. Like I said, someone intelligent, either maybe they listened to our book club and listened to all of my complaints, and we'll take all that stuff out because it's almost what they did. This is another scene, and it will end with one of those 41 uses of the word normal. But this usage, this context, is very common in the book. This is not the first time that it gets used in this manner. So this is Starr and Chris. They're hanging out. They've got the news. They're not going to indict for Khalil's shooting death by the enforcement officer, Officer 115. They're not going to indict. So this is Starr and Chris hanging out together. So Starr's talking. She says, he doesn't get it, but I don't want to talk about it anymore. I want to get so caught up in him that the grand jury's decision isn't even a thing. I kiss his lips, which always have and always will be perfect. He kisses me back, and soon we're making out like it's the only thing we know how to do. It's not enough. My hands travel below his chest, and he's bulging in more than his arms. I start unzipping his jeans. He grabs my hand. Whoa, what are you doing? What do you think? His eyes search mine. Star, I want to. I do. I know you do, and it's the perfect opportunity. I trail kisses along his neck, getting each of those perfectly placed freckles. Nobody's here but us. but we can't. He says, voice strained. Not like this. Why not? I slip my hand in his pants, heading for the bulge. Because you're not in a good place. I stop. He looks at me, and I look at him. My vision blurs. Chris wraps his arms around me and pulls me closer. I bury my face in his shirt. He smells like a perfect combination of Lever soap and Old Spice. The thump of his heart is better than any beat he's ever made. My normal in the flesh.
Ooh.
I know. I said, oh, that's such a good one. That's such a good one. Reading is more important than watching television. Although I'll say again, the word racism, the book that they are saying right now, people jumping up and down, you want to talk to your children about racism and understand why George Floyd was killed and understand why Breonna Taylor was killed. The word racism is in that book one time. The word normal is in that book 41 times, and I could have picked quite a few. That was a really good one because of the context, but I could have picked a whole lot where normal gets conflated with white. Your thoughts on that passage and why that one also got bumped from the movie?
Yeah, I mean, it's one that actually contradicts. I mean, there are other characters who, at least at what, you know, there are lots of uses of the word normal. There's one specific moment where there are characters, and it's notably it's not Star, but it's, you know, Seven and Devante, who actually criticize the use of the word normal. This is a moment in which, you know, the gross injustice has happened, and, you know, the murderous officer has not been charged, and, you know, her response is to find or reestablish a normal with this boyfriend. I mean, it's sort of the opposite of working for justice or hoping for justice. This is about finding something to take your mind off the problem, right? And that definition of normal is the definition of normal that allows that system to be normalized, right, to continue. But if I might, there's another moment where Seven and Devante call out Chris on something that's relevant to, you know, Electric Boogaloo and other things, if I may. Chris says, why do some black people give their kids odd names? I mean, look at you guys' names. They're not normal. My name normal, Devante says, all puffed up sounding. I don't know what you're talking about. Man, you named after a dude from Derdechi, Seven says. And you named after a number. What's your middle name, eh? And I think that line was in the movie about the middle name being eight. Anyway, Chris, Seven says, Devante's got a point. What makes his name or our names any less normal than yours? Who or what defines normal to you? If my pops were here, he'd say you've fallen into the trap of the white standard. And so that's what Seven says. You know, the Maverick character would critique this use of the word normal, but that's exactly the trap that I think Star has fallen into in that passage that you just read, Mr. Renegade.
She says it many times in the text where she's frustrated about the trial and what's happened to Khalil and lots of things that she wants her normal, Chris. She refers to Chris as her normal a number of times in the text. And that scene, I talked about the tragic arrangement, black female with a white male in this context, and particularly in this context of what's happened, the shooting in the book, it happens immediately. Like, that's right, like chapter one, immediately when you're getting into the text. But that's kind of the setting for this interracial romance, is the shooting death of this black child. And then you heard, it gets pretty explicit. I said, this is kind of softcore porn for a young adult book, in my opinion, because they have more than one scene that's like what I just read. But that fits the theme with what we talked about in terms of the sexual representation of black people in a lot of the films and books that we've talked about today. They're also, in the book, they have Maverick, Star's father, who has had children with, you know, all these other folks. That's a source of tension in the marriage, that he's had, you know, this child, Seven, outside their marriage or relationship or whatever. And even Aisha, she's fussed at, and I think Khalil's mom as well, for all of them kind of being reckless and, you know, poor moms and all the rest of it. Some of the themes that we've talked about today. What do you make of the attorney? I guess she was representing Star, kind of. She wanted Star to speak out for Khalil. Miss Ofra, she is played by Issa Rae. If folks know her, she has the HBO series Insecure, which kind of evolved from her web series Awkward Black Girl. But she's the attorney, Miss Ofra, who's kind of encouraging folks like, let's, you know, be activists and, you know, let's stand up, not just let the shooting happen. I thought it was interesting to have her play that role specifically because, particularly in the book, it's slightly minimized in the movie, but I mean, it's really rife in the book in terms of what we talked about in terms of placing the blame at black people, and having King as the substitute villain and his kind of thugs, and even Maverick to some degree, because he's been in prison and had this affair and illicit child and everything. This toxic masculinity is even Khalil, you know, he's being accused of being a drug seller, and he was selling drugs before the shooting. Toxic masculinity is very present in the book. Issa Rae, in one of her most recent seasons of her HBO series, that was what they made the theme: toxic black masculinity. Not toxic masculinity as a whole, but toxic black masculinity specifically. And even that has been pointed to by some critics to say, hey, toxic black masculinity, that's why George Floyd got killed. He was resisting arrest. That's why black people, some of the critiques that we heard from Kelly's parents in Boogaloo, that black people just don't behave themselves and they waste money, and that's why they keep running into problems. Do any thoughts on her being cast in the role of the kind of attorney activist leading this charge against Khalil's death, where she's kind of in her series prominently come out to talk about toxic black masculinity?
Well, that just makes me sadder again, because I thought the portrayal of the attorney, April Ofra, was, I thought it would be a pretty strong one, that she is making demands for justice. And it seems to me that, yeah, in the logic of the story, she's one of the ones who would be not on the side, from the storytelling standpoint, of placing the blame on the black community, but in looking to the black community to call out for justice. But I was not aware how that, you know, casting, you know, if it's tied to that logic of emphasizing black blame, is also part of under the overall trajectory of the movie and the book, of undercutting that message. But I was not aware of that. I didn't see that in her performance. Maybe if I watched it again, it would be a different experience now. Talking about blaming the person in the movie and the person in the book who does that kind of explicit blaming, like that we saw in Electric Boogaloo. Is Haley. Haley is the one that is given that line that we, you know, hear all too often to, you know, excuse a police officer who has killed a black man. Haley's line is he was just doing his job. Khalil was to be blamed for that. In a strange way, something I think about that is Haley's not telling the truth, but there might be more truth in that statement. You know, he was just doing his job. Not that 115 is not to be blamed, but it's also, if that's true, if he was just doing his job, then the problem is with the job and what the purpose of the job is. And it seems to me like the attorney character, April Ofra, would be one of the elements in this book to the like Maverick to the extent to whatever extent they're not in the cut that would be speaking up for that side of calling for justice.
That might have been their intent, but just her series gets a lot of publicity. Insecure, even Awkward Black Girl, it's got a lot of publicity and it's been rolling for quite some time, or at least they've done a number of seasons. But I know that they did have that as a topic, and that's kind of a theme in this book as well. I'll get in one clip and then we'll check, see if folks have any questions they would like to get in. There's there are a number of tacky scenes in the book and film, but there's a scene where Chris, this is Star's white boyfriend, they have left the prom and they're going to meet Maverick for the first time. I already read the scene in the book, so this is substantially different than the text. So they're going to meet him for the first time, and they have this conversation about what does it mean to be black before they go in the house. We'll pick it up here and get Dr. Kevorkian's thoughts.
I suggest you get some color real quick.
I've got color on the inside, where it counts.
All right, man. Well, I think it's time we test your black card. Which one for Thanksgiving? Sweet potato pie or pumpkin?
Sweet potato pie all day.
Ding, 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 ding.
Okay.
That's my baby.
Okay,
right?
hold on.
He knows what's up.
We're not done. Mac and cheese. Full meal or side dish? Full meal.
Womp, womp, womp.
What? That mac and cheese ain't no full meal,
Mm-mm.
man. It's a meal out of a box.
Oh, no, baby. No, it comes out the oven. Mm-hmm. Bubbly,
yep.
Cheesy, crispy.
Preach.
On top.
Macaroni and cheese is a protein. You sprinkle breadcrumbs on top of it.
Breadcrumbs?
Oh, hell no. Nah. No, that ain't gonna cut it. Y'all both dead. Excuse me.
Streaming for free on Amazon and other outlets. What do we make? That's our representation of blackness. Macaroni and cheese, sweet potato pie. What do we make of that's how we understand being black in a system of white supremacy?
Yeah, I mean, the way that the scene plays out, I mean, it to me, it's a kind of a microcosm of what I thought was going to happen with the Chris character, but what didn't happen. You know, I thought the Chris character was going to be a character who would allow for there to be scenes in which a white person says ignorant things and then some education takes place and limitations of that ignorance are revealed. And, you know, that, again, I thought this might be, it looked like at one point it's heading towards the idea that, you know, Star says, at one point she says, you know, we don't belong together. She kind of comes to this realization. She has that clarity that someone who doesn't get it to the profound extent that this guy doesn't get it, you know, is not for her. In this scene, he says this ridiculous thing, you know, I have color on the inside where it counts, where clearly the whole story so far is about how the disproportionate treatment people have received just based on how they look on the outside. That's the whole problem. It's not about this myth of, you know, not seeing color or having color on the inside. He's not at risk with the cop in the way the black man was. It's this profoundly ignorant statement, color on the inside where it counts. And the brother, I think it's Seven, laughs. And I thought, okay, he's going to get mocked or he's going to really not let that pass. As a statement, but then he moves on, he says, laughs and says, all right, man. And then he moves to the so-called black card test, in which, you know, somehow now the test of quote-unquote authentic blackness is reduced to how so well someone knows stereotypes. It seems like the opposite, you know. You know, whether he knows whether it's supposed to be, you know, whether sweet potato pie is the right answer or not. I will say there was some wit in this discussion of, you know, whether macaroni and cheese is a meal or not, or the protein or whole thing, but it's completely misplaced in this particular scene that's a setup for a very serious thing that's about to happen. I mean, you could sort of see, you know, kids off in a completely another context having this lighthearted discussion about the nature of macaroni and cheese. But this that just seemed like a conversation from a completely different story or a different moment than these characters would be experiencing right then in the wake of this grave injustice and before going to meet the father on whom he wants to make a good impression.
For sure. And particularly since the Black Panthers, they're mentioned in the book and in the movie, like they could have quizzed him, you know, who's Dr. Huey P. Newton? You know, asked him about that. When was the Black Panther Party? They could have asked him some questions like that, and that would have been right within the context of the story and what Maverick talked about. But I mean, it's just reduced to, as I said, worst book ever. We're just reduced to the same tacky cliche. Racism is alive and well. What do black people like? Fried chicken and sweet potato pie. That's the hell. Same. And this is, again, something where, that was on the New York Times bestseller list. This is what's being recommended right now. You want to understand racism, get this book. Then you can answer all the great questions about, you know, what foods black people like, watermelon and fried chicken and all the rest of it. They switched the scene around, right? So I read the prom scene. And I think that's an important point, too, that there's a lot of, I mean, it's a young adult book, right? But there's a lot of, like, misplaced humor and silliness in this book that is literally on the corpse of a black male. Like, the book starts with the shooting and then everything goes from there. And like the prom scene, they've just got this news, they're not, the grand jury, they're not going to indict and all this, and now is when we're going to joke and go to prom and maybe make out. Like, really? I mean, it just seems like consistently, unless that is a part of white supremacy racism, which is what I've said. That's a part of what I've said about this book for a long time, why it would be recommended, why it's so popular. We are about necrophilia in the system of racism, white supremacy, and make entertainment out of black people dying. You know, we'll watch live streams. That's why George Floyd, they got video. That will just stream and be looped on television and TikTok and social media outlets and all of that. Like, they end up making entertainment documentary films about Tamir Rice, the fella in New York who died, I forgot, Jay-Z made the documentary. Khalif Browder will make lots of, Sandra Bland probably got more of these to come, Eric Garner and Michael Brown Jr. and George Floyd, he'll probably get a documentary too. But this is the way that the movie did the prom scene. We'll see if it's any better. It just doesn't have the sexual grotesqueries, but we'll see if this portion is any better, and then we'll nab our callers. Our last scene from The Hate U Give, Chris and Star at the prom.
Hey.
It's you, right? You told me you didn't know Khalil.
Yeah, I knew him.
Did you not think that I was gonna find out? Were you just gonna hide everything from me?
It's not like that.
Star, I'm your boyfriend. That's what I'm here for.
It's not like I don't trust you.
Then what's it like? Tell me, please.
Chris, I don't live in Williamson. If I had told everybody, I would have been poor Star who saw her friend get killed. Or Star the charity case who lives in the ghetto.
Do you think people really care about where you live?
Yeah, I do. Jeez. Have you ever seen somebody die?
No.
I have twice now. That's why my parents put me and my brothers in Williamson. To protect us. And now, it's like I have to hide who I am every single day. When I'm at home, I can't be too Williamson. When I'm here, I can't act too Garden Heights. Khalil's my first crush. My first kiss. And he was going through so much shit. And I didn't even know. Because I turned my back on him. I turned my back on all of my people. Do you even know what that's like?
No. a black, white. Nobody gives a shit. We're all the same.
But we're not. Y'all want to act black, but you get to keep your white privilege. You think playing ball and jumping in some lame-ass Williamson cipher makes you understand what it is to be black? It doesn't.
Star, I just told you, I don't see color. I see people for who they are the exact same way I see you.
If you don't see my blackness, you don't see me.
I see you.
Unfortunately, the crowd is not present at the movie version to boo, but, you know, we can insert that here. So is that any better than what we read from the book, Dr. Kevorkian?
No. I mean, I was reflecting on several aspects of it in terms of both the scene that you read earlier and something that you said a moment ago. About there are these jokes or these lighthearted moments or these moments of entertainment. Not that this is lighthearted, but this is, you know, the after prom, about these moments that are on over the corpse of a dead black man, Khalil. When, you know, Chris says at the beginning, and kind of very accusingly, didn't you think I'd find out, right? It's nominally just about the fact that Star knew Khalil. But the way he says it, that's the line of someone who's jealous. That's the line of someone who's caught someone cheating, right? Didn't you think I'd find out that you were with this other guy? And in a certain sense, I'm starting to think, you know, the logic of this story is that this is a romantic story that also exists over the dead body of Khalil, right? That Star at the beginning is attracted to him, and she's sort of feeling conflicted about it. It's played a little differently in the book and in the movie. And the movie, you know, there's a kiss with Khalil, but nevertheless, she starts having feelings for Khalil again. And says, "Oh, but I've got a boyfriend." And so you've got a classic love triangle set up, but the way the book, in a sense, you could say, resolves that tension is to get rid of Khalil. Like, Star can be with Chris because Khalil is out of the picture. And the other line that was sticking with me from that scene that you read earlier, with Maverick, is, you know, if this was a rom-com, right? Well, in certain bizarre ways, in certain, you know, misplaced moments, it is a rom-com, right? But it's a rom-com that the romantic resolution of which is made possible first by the absence of Khalil, and then also, you know, glossing over the misunderstanding and the injustices that follow from his death. I mean, it seems like there's a moment in the middle of the conversation where Chris gives a true answer when she says, "Do you need to know what that's like, you know, to see someone die?" And he says, "No." But then he immediately follows it up with this false cliche of, "Oh, I don't see color." And then she challenges him. And at the end he says, "I see you." But at the moment where he says, "I see you," I don't feel like he's given any reason for the audience to believe that that is true. He's just said another one of his, you know, ignorant things right before that. So it feels like a false resolution.
Extremely so, and absolutely. So-called love triangle, we resolve, not the conventional way, we resolve it by immediately killing the black male, and then we can, you know, just deal with his absence as our romance evolves afterwards. Like, that is the, so even reminded me of Halle Berry she won her Academy Award, where her romance with Billy Bob Thornton could only take place after her son was killed. Forgot. Monster's Ball. Yes, Monster's Ball. Always getting rid of the black males. Get out of here. We'll get our callers. Just that thing of the wayward black sexuality, it's even right here. Now, I read about the sexual aggressiveness that's in the book. It's a little bit more explicit in the book. They cut a lot of that out of the film, but the same pattern. The black female is the one that's the aggressor. The scene that I read with regards to their sexual intercourse. Earlier in the book, the character Jess is one of Star's schoolmates at her white school. She's cut out of the movie. This is one of the white girls there, and she sticks up for Star a few times when they have these racist incidents. But the book reads, talking about Jess, poor girl, I pat her hair, I have a secret crush on Jess's pixie cut, my neck's not long enough for one, but her hair is perfect, every strand is where it should be. If I were into girls, I would totally date her for her hair, and she would date me for my shoulder. And they have, this is not the only spot in the book where she makes this comment specifically about Jess, and oh man, if I was in the females, I would be all about some Jess. And I mean, just what in the world? Like, she doesn't say that about any black characters, to just have this moment where we've already got over the corpse of a dead black child. Oh, and this is a child. Khalil is not a man. I think he's a child. He's one of, they're the same age, so he'd have to be a child. This to be happening over the corpse of Khalil, where to have all of this just randomly inserted, like sexualization and fetishizing of white people, like, oh, she's so beautiful, I would date her if I was into girls, and then she's already got it with Chris. It just, what? And again, this is the book that's being recommended. Yes, read this book to understand racism, where we will, you know, glow and gloat on and worship white people over the corpse of a dead black child. It's formerly the worst book I ever read. I could talk a little, we did a whole book club, talked about it for months. Let's see if folks have questions. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question. Let's see, Henry in Chicago, hand up. Did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? You should be with us.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to Dr. Kevorkian. Question in regards to Breaking to Electric Boogaloo. Could you comment on the significance of the place in the movie called The Miracle, which was the center of the whole movie? Why was that? Was there a significance in picking that name, Miracle, in that movie? That's all I have in my line.
Oh, thank you very much, Henry in Chicago. Thank you for that question. Yeah, I hadn't commented on that. I did write it down as one of the things, and I think it's a setup again in some way that is betrayed, right? That the miracle that you're initially supposed to believe in is the power of this artistic expressive community, that they're, let's put on a show, we'll save miracles, we'll create our own miracle, and something that we can all believe in together, and they put on a show, and they get pretty far. Ice-T puts on a concert, gets them up to $150,000, but they need $200,000, and again, as Mr. Renegade pointed out, it's the wealthy white father who then sweeps in and can make the grand gesture. It's like, the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which is not really about miracles, but about, buying a certain experience for someone, nothing against that particular organization. But again, this is the miracle at the end is something that could be bought by the privileged, wealthy white man as sort of a whim to get back in good graces with his daughter. It doesn't really cost him much. So I think that, you want to hope that it's this beautiful thing, that a miracle will be born here in this expressive culture. But I think it's a miracle that the logic of the movie lets down at the end.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Let's see, our caller, I guess you're on the Skype line, Vic. You're on the Skype line. Did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? You should be with us.
Oh, yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Dr. Kevorkian. I'd like to really thank you for all of the years that you've been on the calls and, doing your movie reviews. I've gotten to the point where, I'll be like listening to the movies that you and Gus have commented on, and then I'd be like going to different shows and then analyzing the show. Now I've gotten to the point where because of the COVID-19, I'm staying with my father. So we're watching this television show called The Jeffersons. Now it's a comedy show. It was developed by Norman Lear. And there are a lot of images that make the character George Jefferson be in a subservient role. There's a neighbor of George Jefferson, and his name is Mr. Bentley. The character is Mr. Bentley. And what happens with Mr. Bentley is sometimes his back goes out. So what George does, Mr. Bentley lies on the ground, and then George walks on his back. When I thought about that when I was a kid, I used to thought, oh, you know, this is all funny, you know, this is just games. But George is playing, the character George is playing as an observant role, serving someone who's in a position of power or who are classified as white. So I just didn't notice those things, and through listening to the cows, I've gotten to learn about, you know, understanding what I'm seeing within the context of racism, white supremacy. And I just want to thank you.
Thank you very much, Vic, and all best to you and your father. And you know, right, I mean, this is an illustration of again, you know, as Mr. Renegade says about, you know, reading, you know, being more important than watching television. You know, I watched television when I was growing up. I saw The Jeffersons, and I don't think, you know, I didn't notice it then at that time. But, you know, I read some books like Invisible Man after that, right? And in retrospect, that scene that you talk about, George walking on Mr. Bentley's back, you know, that is, you know, the work of a servant, and it's clearly visible. And Mr. Bentley, is he long, like with a British accent too? So like kind of super, super ultra white guy. But yeah, I mean, and again, this is about, you know, containing the idea that Jefferson's is about ostensibly the upper trajectory of someone achieving, you know, Black middle class status, wealth, being a successful businessman. I think you're into dry cleaning service, you know, but it's all about moving on up to the east side and getting a piece of the pie and that sort of thing. But so I think it's even more important to see how that upwards Black ascent is then still contained within what Vic, what you're saying, even that, you know, somebody who's being portrayed as supposedly successful, having moved out of that previous role, is still being put back into it. So thank you very much for that insight about the Jeffersons, and thank you for listening and calling in.
Hopefully worthy of your time and energy. Yes, I said that. Lots of folks, I suspect, are probably at home. That is an interesting viewing choice for the quarantine. Like, wow, I have heard a lot of selections, things people have checked out since being down. But the Jeffersons, like, wow, Norman Lear from 50 years, that's went further back than Breaking 2. Like, wow. I will say, since we're trying to make sure we get, you know, as many patterns as we can, this might be, I think, at least the third time. My memory's bad. I haven't watched The Jeffersons since we've been shut in. But I think that would be at least our third illustration this evening of a Black person who is presented as being racist, because I think George is portrayed as having a problem with white people. I think he says honky. I think I could bet you I could find a meme before we go off the air where he's calling a white person a honky and complaining about Tom and some of the other white neighbors. Like, that would be at least our third time this evening where we have a racist Black person who doesn't like white people. Let's see. The person, Irie, in Louisiana. Do you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? You should be with us.
Yes, hi. I hope everybody's doing good tonight. I just want to add really quick, I didn't get to watch all the films. I did see The Electric Boogaloo when I was younger, but I really didn't want to sit through it again. I did watch The Hate U Give and Striking Vipers. And one thing I noticed about the actor, Anthony Mackie, he does tend to agree to take roles that are kind of antithetical to masculinity, black masculinity, if I can use that phrase. Like, I remember my first exposure to him in film was actually She Hate Me, in which it's a film where he is literally breeded like a stud or a buck or something for pay while he's out of work. So I just noticed that's the type of roles he likes to take. I'm not claiming to know why, but it's just an observation, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Irie in Louisiana, and I hope you hope all is everyone's healthy and safe out your way as well. Thank you for those good thoughts. Yeah, I mean, no, I don't want to pile on Anthony Mackie. I mean, we are still talking about as Mr. Renegade will remind us, is a system, and a system in which there are especially in right now we're analyzing movies, but we're analyzing a certain numbers of stories that are being told. There's infinite possibilities in theory, but in practice, there are only, so many roles available for working actors. I'm not saying that, that again, that the agent can be getting in better roles, but another series that I've seen in some episodes is the most recent season called Altered Carbon, and it's kind of almost the flip side, but to the same result, of Striking Vipers, where in Striking Vipers, he plays an embodied black man who then has this, fantasy world where he takes on an avatar who's of a different identity. In Altered Carbon, Anthony Mackie is the character of someone who's called a sleeve. And so he's this like super high tech enhanced soldier type guy body that's just a body. And forever living other character inhabits him and uses his body as what's called a sleeve. So another way in which he's being cast in a role in which his, in this case, his body is just being used and controlled by someone else. I don't want to sidetrack too much, but I also wanted to remark how, in the past we've talked about films that have been flawed or books, things that are flawed, but they might have something that is of value in them. Mr. Renegade and I had a discussion one time about the movie Precious, I recall, and that movie had all kinds of problems, particularly with portrayal of black men and, again, blaming black people for their problems and black fathers in particular, that sort of problem. But it also contained the line that I still come back to and I remind people of it. One of the things that Precious learns is don't ever let anyone tell you that you're stupid. And I always thought, that's a really solid line. That's something that anyone I hope can hang on to. Don't ever let anyone tell you that you're stupid. Because we live in a world, particularly under a system of white supremacy, where the lie is always being told to non-white people. It's a lie that they are stupid, and it is a lie, and so that should never happen. Kind of the equivalent for that, for me, in The Hate U Give, is a line that Maverick says to her, to Star. He says, God gave you a brain, you don't need theirs. God gave you a brain, you don't need theirs, and I think that's a good one to live by too. But again, I think the Anthony Mackie character as Sleeve is kind of a literalization of that problem of this black body that's portrayed as super technologically enhanced, but then requires activation by a different brain. That's for the long answer.
Wow. Not seen that series, totally unfamiliar with it, but Anthony Mackie as a sleeve, wow, that is color monitors, no thinking there, no thinking at all. Wow, yeah, he's a victim. I think some folks have pointed it out too. We are in a system of white supremacy, so it's not like you can expect that we're not going to get films that, or in fact, you can expect the films will support white supremacy, racism, and particularly the roles that black people are limited to. I just will say really quick about She Hate Me. Anthony Mackie's in that, where he doesn't have a job, I think, and that's the job that he gets. That's the work that he gets, is to impregnate other females, as she said, like, you know, a stud on the plantation. I don't think I thought of it in that context at the time. It's been some years since I've seen the film, but yeah, I don't think I thought of it in that context. Like, oh, just, you know, something silly or what have you, but that, yeah, just go out and have sex with a bunch. I think he ends up in some sort of sexual arrangement with two females who are lesbians, and same thing we've been talking about, sexual, all kinds of sexual wackiness in these films where black people are the lead roles. The number is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-POUND. We'll take a second, see if any other folks have a question that they want to make sure they get in before we let Dr. Kevorkian ride for the evening. I know, make sure I didn't miss For the Hate You Give, because I know I did have an extra comment there. They did not have the line, "I got your back," is used relentlessly in the book. I ended up joking about it because it was used so often in the book, but they did not use that at all in the movie. I would have made it a sound clip if they had. Let's see. The they do. There's in the book, there's talk of the Black Panthers that gets erased from the movie. They have the character 40 Ounce, who's also in the book. He's not in the movie, but he can't get his name right. He calls him Dr. Huey, whatever. And at one point, she's going over like, yeah, we learned the Black Panthers 10-point program and their history and all the things that they did. But Dr. Huey Newton died as a crackhead and blah, blah, blah. Like, there's a number of lines where they speak in what I would view as kind of a disparaging way about the Black Panther Party, and all of that is removed from the film. They just have Maverick giving his really impassioned scene where he's quizzing them about the 10-point program and kind of encouraging Star to speak up and use her voice. Just your thoughts on the remarks about the Black Panthers in the book, and then why those might have been left out of the film?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was more extensive, and it comes up at more than one point in the book, and you know, she's quizzed on it. You know, there's more talk about Huey Newton. I mean, and there's sort of that give and take between Maverick, the one shop owner, and I believe Mr. Lewis, the barber shop owner. Mr. Lewis likes Mr. King, and Maverick upholds Huey Newton, and maybe they're going to try to have them both depicted. But yeah, there are some strong things that Maverick says in the extended version of that speech. And another one of them, again, is that how that those principles then apply to the thug life saying that the hate you give. And the way that Maverick says it in the longer scene, he's talking about, again, the drugs coming from outside to destroy the community, says, and the lack of opportunity, says, that's the hate they're giving us, baby, a system designed against us. That's thug life. It's a system designed against us. And so that's talking explicitly about not systemic racism again, but a system of white supremacy, to go back to that original linguistic distinction that your caller recently, you know, made. That's something that's in that moment Maverick is making explicit in the book, in the context of talking about the history of the Black Power movement, and which doesn't make it in the movie, which again then erases that idea of the hate you give and changes it to the hate we give.
It is I was surprised. I'll have to say, we read the book in 2018, and the film came out. I was not pleased with the book, so there was no way I was going to sit through the film. So then 2 years later, we get here, and the film and book are being regularly recommended. So I say, they've made it free on every platform and what have you. I'll review the film since everyone is talking about this now again. And I was surprised just at the amount of material that did not get, again, I totally get it. Everything can't go in the movie, but it almost reads a little bit differently. Content that's in the book, content that's in the film and or not. Characters that they left out, lines that they left out. Again, I will say Maverick in the book is a lot weaker, like substantially weaker than what you see in the movie. Just the number of different scenes and instances where everybody, like I said, all the characters kind of ignore and ridicule him. He is not a powerful figure, and or remind everybody about his jail time or remind everybody about his infidelity and that type of thing. Like, it's the Maverick character especially, like quite a few things are different, but Maverick's representation especially, which I find baffling, because she said the author, Angie Thomas, of The Hate U Give, a black female, she said Maverick was her favorite character, and she, you know, gave a really, I'm sure has given many really impassioned interviews where she's talked about how it was so important for her to have the portrayal of a strong black father and all of that. That is lacking. I said that repeatedly. It just staggered me repeatedly as I read the book, because I feel like he's presented as kind of a weak figure in the book, and I guess I'll stop there. Am I off? You read the book and watched the film. Do you feel the representation he's presented in a much weaker form in the book than in the film?
Absolutely no. I mean, there are continually, you know, to use that language of that other scene, there are points scored against him all the time in the book, in a way that, again, I think it was a stronger performance. I mean, I did see an interview with the cast. And, you know, Russell Hornsby did talk about what he appreciated about what he knew of people's lives that he saw in the book, and that he tried to bring that to life. You hear the, you know, Regina Hall and Russell Hornsby talking about it. It's almost like they're not quite saying of it, but like we're trying to find that core, trying to find those moments that we could portray that could be moments of strength. You know, that Regina Hall talks about bearing weight for your friends and your community. And she said the book had that, like had that in the past tense. Like you could find it just in places. The director, George Tillman, talks about Star's journey being one of finding her voice in this process of code switching. But he says that she was compromised by constantly trying to find herself between these two things. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, used the word compromise to describe what happens to Star. And I also kind of wonder if he didn't at some level, wasn't he signaling that, you know, he recognizes that he's doing the best he can with the materials be given, with all the pressures and directives that he's being given, and the screenwriter, a white screenwriter, comes in and works on it. But, you know, there's inevitably something is compromised.
Now, that's something that the folks involved in the project, the filmmakers themselves, coming out and saying that, like, wow, that is important. Wow. You could, at least in my view, you could look at a lot of different ways. But, I mean, yeah, her friend is dead, and the book still kind of in some ways ends on a happy note. Like, the family moves and Chris is accepted by her family, and yeah, the love triangle thing has been resolved successfully and all is well, kind of in an odd kind of way. Like, I did not enjoy the movie. The book was formerly worst book ever. I think The Invisible Man, I think, is a much better book. That's the book that we read after we read The Hate U Give. I had to cleanse my palate, so we read Invisible Man, which was, wow, just spectacular again, always is. A much better book. In fact, one to end, I don't even know if I've heard Invisible Man mentioned this time, but I would certainly think folks could get a lot more out of that book than The Hate U Give or the movie. But they in Chicago had a rumor that a black fella had stolen a horse. when they had all the protests and unrest and all of that, they'd stolen a police horse and people got upset and vandalized his residence and his car. And it turns out that this black guy actually owned a horse and he had been riding around in the neighborhood and at some of the protests on his horse. And somehow a lie got started that he, not that he raped a white woman, but that he stole a police horse of all things. And the zaniness ensued. But that got brought up on the program. And one of our listeners says, oh, wow, don't they steal a horse in Invisible Man? Isn't that with all the zaniness when they steal the milk truck and are throwing that out and all after Todd Clifton's been shot? And I cracked up laughing like, oh, yeah, they do steal a horse. Like, oh, my gosh. Like, best book ever to capture, you know, what's happening. Or if you just want to learn about racism at any time, Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison, just spectacular. I'll make that, I think, I didn't see any other hands, so I'll assume folks are good. I'll make that my last pitch. Did you see the report where they stole the horse? And that's an Invisible Man, yes?
It is, absolutely. I did not see that report. That's a brilliant connection, and I'll just say it's. I think it's the greatest American novel ever. It's just a masterpiece, on in every way. Just in terms of its form and in terms of its truth. And I'll just say again. Early on in The Hate U Give, the main character Star says, I'm invisible, but it's not, it doesn't have the same weight, it doesn't have the same gravity, it's not the same situation. She's talking about, she's complaining that she feels invisible at a party in the neighborhood because she, you know, is caught, you know, she's coming there back from Williamson World, back to her own neighborhood, and says, you know, I'm not getting enough attention at this party, I'm invisible. And, you know, compare that to the analysis of what invisibility means to Invisible Man, that, you know, a system of white supremacy and white people who refuse to see the humanity in this character. It's a completely different take on what it means to be invisible.
I'd say with The Hate U Give, Khalil kind of becomes invisible in some respects in the book. I'll say specifically, he kind of gets submerged for, you know, the romance and all the other things and oh, that no good king. And it's like, didn't somebody get shot at the beginning of this thing that we were supposed to be upset about? Like, oh, yeah, king. Never mind. We got king. We got substitute villain, as you said. Never mind. We got king and all's well that ends well. Whew. Wow. I'm glad we got through it all. Hopefully it was of some constructive value. Lots of different patterns and even lots of connections within the films that we talked about today that span about 40 years or so. The book, again, you can check it out. Some of our listeners got copies before. I hope they read it. Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America, Dr. Martin Kevorkian, University of Texas, Austin. Always a pleasure to have you on the broadcast. Always feel like I learn a lot. Hopefully listeners do as well. If anything, be more critical. Don't just plop down with the Netflix or Hulu stream or whatever you're watching. White supremacy content is pretty ongoing, so be alert, be mindful, or might be getting more of that racist content that impacts how you think, how you go out and function in the world. Has been a pleasure as always, Dr. Kevorkian.
Thank you so much, Mr. Renegade. Thank you to you. And thank you to your callers and your listeners. And I always learn a great deal. It's been an honor. So thank you so much, sir.
Enjoy your evening. We will speak soon. We will speak soon, sir. Take excellent care.
Thank you. You as well, please.
For sure. For sure. Context of White Supremacy, Dr. Martin Kevorkian. Again, he's been with us a bunch of times. We talked about the book and lots of films. We talked about Invisible Man, too. I forgot, if you read Invisible Man, we have a great little study guide in the archives. I think he was with us 2010, I believe, where we talked about the book Invisible Man, favorites, and then we read the entire book in the book club in 2018, right after The Hate U Give. So if you listen to The Hate U Give in the archives, you can listen to Invisible Man right afterwards. Wow. Whew. Lots of work for these, but so much work to get all the sound clips and everything together, and then to go and try to get notes and everything and collate. Hope it's worth it. I'm pretty sure The Hate U Give, I'm pretty sure a good chunk of folks have either seen the film, read the book, both maybe are going to see it, not necessarily because we talked about it now, but just it's been, you know, recommended so many places where they've said, oh yeah, you should watch this film, or children should check this film out. So if anything, you'll have another little companion guide to kind of accompany and ask some questions and rethink some aspects of the film, as well as with the rest. Again, dangerous times on the plantation, system of racism, white supremacy. Take it seriously, white folks and their guns and everything else. I think that will be a problem for the remainder of the year. That got brought up with quite a few of the films that we talked about, the Boogaloo and all. Folks are all satisfied. Anything they need to get in before we wrap out, give like 1 second. We should be here this coming Thursday for the book club. Einstein on Race and Racism, Fred Jerome, Roger Taylor. We just started last Thursday, so, you know, if you didn't get to hear last week, you are not far behind. You can pick up, I don't think we got to like chapter 3, chapter 4. The chapters are small too, so we didn't read maybe 30 pages or so. We'll pick up this Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The little bit that we read last week was really enjoyable. This is a book that Dr. Welsing told us to read more than once. He mentioned it by name and author in 2014. And thus far, wow, she hooked us up. We really haven't even gotten to the meat of the topic yet. So Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Einstein on Race and Racism. Again, you can drop an email. Let us know if you are looking for information. Details for the CALS Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat in Washington, D.C., August 5th through the 9th. Drop an email and we can let you know if you have any questions, details, if you want to come to the nation's capital later this summer for yoga, counter-racist workshops, plant-based meals, and no contagions, taking all the precautions to stay safe so we are not, you know, taking anything back when we go home. Drop an email and let me know. Looking forward to doing some hanging out and talking about being healthy in the midst of all the crisis. Looking like folks are all satisfied. Nothing else they need to get in before we conclude. Grand, the Jeffersons. Man, it's been ages. The Jeffersons. Did we talk about the Jeffersons? I don't think we've talked about the Jeffersons on the program before, but wow. Racism, white supremacy is going to be in any of the content. Again, if you are watching TV, or even my suggestion, if you're going to watch content with other people, you could just pick one thing to have them watch about. You don't have to talk during the whole film. I've heard from many folks that that can be super annoying, so maybe don't talk during the whole film. Just give like maybe one thing that they can pay attention to and just be mindful of as they're watching. I have found that that can be very effective. If you've seen it and they kind of let you know ahead of time, oh, I'm going to watch The Hate U Give. Like, oh, okay, just watch, you know, Mavericks, you know, treatment. You can pay attention to that or anything. Just one element. I found that if you give people that, they will pay attention to it. They will come back. They'll talk about it. I found that works very well as opposed to just kind of chatting and interrupting during the viewing experience, because most people, they still kind of want to, you know, watch and be entertained, so to speak. Anywho, we'll be here Thursday. Hopefully, it's been a constructive investment of your Tuesday, Monday evening, getting so ahead of myself. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, racism. Man, need our brain computer working well so that we can go about the business of solving the problem. In addition to remaining sober, let's be buckled every time we are in a vehicle. Again, I would encourage, let's be strategic. I've noticed, you know, traffic has picked up, it's warm, it's officially summer and all that, and states are reopening, or areas, locations are reopening. Do your business if you're going to work or if you have errands to run, no problem. I would still be super vigilant, super alert. Anything looks awry, take evasive action. Get out of that area. This is not the time to be risky. And if you don't have to be out and about, once, you know, work responsibilities are done or you've got whatever else complete with your day, I would not be out gallivanting and such. It's not really a good time. I would be very direct with your business and just be very mindful. There are lots of race soldiers out and about. Many of them have firearms and they are looking for confrontation. With that, so you are buckled, you're sober. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. Just trying to do the little things we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. No name calling. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.